Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
There's so much we don't know about the coronavirus, the exact method of transmission, why it affects some more than others. But one thing that we do know is that it's overwhelming metropolitan areas. Public health advisors say new hotspots are emerging in the U.S. in places like New Orleans, Detroit, and Chicago. Here's Dr. Deborah Birx. She's the coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force.
Our concern about certain counties that look like they're having a more rapid increase, Wayne County in Michigan, and you look at Cook County in Chicago.
In Chicago, there are now more than 2,100 cases of the disease, and the number of cases there is doubling every 2 to 3 days. Joining us now is Dr. Allison Arwoody. She's the commissioner of the Chicago Department of Public Health. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So much of the country's attention has been focused on New York the last couple of weeks, but Detroit, New Orleans, your city, Chicago, are all emerging as hotspots, we just said. What factors do you think are making the spread of the outbreak so intense in those particular cities?
Well, I think most of it just goes back to the fact that in urban areas, a lot of people live in close proximity. We have a lot of people who live in Chicago. We also have a lot of healthcare here in Chicago. And so where we think about people coming in, needing care, there's the potential to really see a lot of spread, I think, in cities. So.
Oh, interesting. Well, I'm curious, how much do you think socioeconomic differences play into who gets affected by the coronavirus?
Yeah. I think it's a really interesting question. At the Chicago Department of Public Health, all the time, we're about health equity. We actually talk a lot about the racial life expectancy gap here in the city of Chicago, where we see black Chicagoans live on average almost 9 years less long than white Chicagoans. Mm-hmm. And where you think about what drives that gap, forgetting about coronavirus, the biggest driver of that racial life expectancy gap are chronic diseases, heart diseases, lung diseases. Exactly the diseases that would put people potentially more at risk for those severe complications or potentially even death from coronavirus. And
right.
So as we're watching, you know, our data here in Chicago, you think about parts of the country that may have these same sorts of life expectancy gaps, you may potentially see more disease in places not only where people live more closely together, but you may have more folks who have more of those underlying conditions. So
absolutely,
it's something we're paying a whole lot of attention to here.
Well, your mayor, Lori Lightfoot, she says that Chicago could see 40,000 hospitalizations. Are you confident that, you know, you'll have the beds, the staff, the equipment like ventilators and masks that you will need to manage that surge of patients?
Right. So Chicago Department of Public Health is certainly one of the most prepared departments, and we're one of the most prepared cities for this. We had a large pandemic flu exercises as recently as last year, talking through in a theoretical way what a pandemic would look like.
Okay.
We have stockpiles of PPE in the ways that I know not all cities do.
Enough,
but nevertheless. Well, exactly. When you look at these kinds of numbers and these kinds of predictions, that is one end of a model, but it's certainly where we see potential for something like that. That is not a number of admissions that we in any way are set up to handle. And
okay.
So at the same time that we're working to increase capacity in our hospitals, this is where we're looking at some of these alternate care facilities. The fact that we're looking at potentially standing up even thousands of beds in McCormick Place points to the fact that we want to be ahead of this. We're hoping that it won't get to that, but we can't wait to be building some of that and thinking ahead if we do get to a point where all of our wonderful acute care hospitals are not able to surge to meet that high demand.
What about the jails there? In the short time we have left, I saw that more than 100 inmates in Cook County Jail have tested positive for coronavirus. How is that factoring into how you're dealing with the outbreak in Chicago?
Yeah, so from the beginning, we've been very focused on congregate settings. So that's our long-term care facilities, certainly our shelter. shelters where folks who are homeless may be, and then the jail. So the health department's been on site working with the jail. We've been working to make sure we're moving folks who are positive. We're testing folks in those areas, taking it very seriously.
That is Dr. Allison Arwitty, the commissioner of the Chicago Department of Public Health. Thank you.
Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, April 2nd, 2020. So I have been told. This is our book club final installment on Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington's Packing Them In, An Archaeology of Environmental Racism in Chicago, 1865 to 1954. The audio segment that we heard at the beginning, more information on the coronavirus, Chinese disease, and specifically how it's impacting Chicago. The thing that has really stood out to me, particularly they were talking about Louisiana, but saying people who are already in poor health are really going to be impacted in terms of fatalities and having more complications from all of this. If you're already in poor health, eating bad food, you live in an environment where you don't have access to clean water and you don't have access to good ventilation. They talked about that. They said that. They said if you're someplace you don't have fresh air, you're cooped up inside and you just got all those germs and things, you're not getting access to fresh air, not good for your respiration, more likely to have problems. Being packed in, warehoused someplace where you just got lots of chemicals, you don't have fresh air, you don't have access to quality produce, don't have good water, I could easily see how it could be much more detrimental. Health encompasses many, many things. I think that was what Mr. Fuller said. That was his justification, or not justification, reasoning, I'll say it that way. Reasoning in terms of why he did not include health as a specific area of people activity, because it encompasses so many things and racists dominate all areas of people activity. So health obviously would be included in that and our health would be compromised. But wow. Anywho, we will proceed. Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington's Packing Them In. We are resuming Chapter 6. We are at the early stages, the subsection We Fight Blight. It's Chapter 6. I was correct. Chapter 6, We Fight Blight. But then we're picking up with the subsection Foundations of the Urban Conservation Movement. Our narrator, Henry in Chicago, has done exemplary work in the midst of the pandemic, has been professional. Johnny on the spot every time, having the audio recordings ready to roll. Bravo, has helped us all learn quite a bit about the Windy City where he resides. Like I said, especially nice touch to have a Chicago resident, parent no less, on to do the narration. But it has been a hoot learning more in the long history of white people polluting chemical and biological warfare against black people. Chapter 6, here we go. Context of White Supremacy, Packing Them In, audio segment number 1.
Foundations of the Urban Conservation Movement, 1915 to 1940. The Block Club movement was the first national organized attempt to deal with unsustainable African American communities in urban settings that emerged from the first Great Migration. The Block Club movement was initiated by the National Urban League's affiliate in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania's Hill District between 1915 and 1920. The formation of the Block Club movement was consistent with the three-pronged objective of the Urban League to help migrating African Americans with employment, housing, and assimilation or adjustment. The movement was based upon the formation of Block Clubs that was designated to be a bulwark of strength for communities to urbanize people in a better way of life. The first Block Club in Chicago, formed by Chicago Urban League staff member Frazier T. Lane, was the Southside Block Club. The League's first secretaries were responsible for organizing and supporting the early neighborhood improvement clubs. Within the first year of its formation, The Chicago Urban League recognized that poor housing was a critical problem for migrating blacks and the rapidly expanding black population. As early as 1917, the league began utilizing African-American women to do their block work, which entailed going into the homes of newly arriving migrants and giving them advice about health, cleanliness, deportment in public places, care of children, overcrowding, and efficiency. The league's first annual report in 1917 emphasized that the housing problem in 1916 was bad for African Americans and that the organization was going to work several angles to resolve the problem. These included getting corporations and capitalists interested in housing construction, having the city see the necessity of preventing occupancy of physically unfit houses, and asking city departments to enforce city ordinances in African American communities. By engaging in these activities, the league sought to create livable spaces for the rapidly expanding African American population by reducing the number of insanitary houses and immoral resorts and preventing overcrowding and extortionate rentals. By the fall of 1917, Chicago Urban League Secretary T. Arnold Hill formally requested white, civic-minded capitalist families to construct new dwellings for Negroes in Chicago's Negro districts. Although the league emphasized in its second annual report that its civic activities in 1917 included using one of its female staff members to go into the homes of the unenlightened and to visit the small, insanitary, and unsightly churches, to call a spade, and touch the heart of the careless, indifferent, and troublesome man and woman. One of its foremost plans for 1918 to 1919 was still to draw attention to insanitary and unfit houses and to high rents until relief is furnished. In 1919, the same year as the Chicago race riot, sustainable housing and access to sustainable housing were the highest priorities for the league. This is not surprising, since many studies about the riot have since concluded that the fight over housing was one of the triggers for the bloodbath. In its 1919 annual report, the league averred that they stood ready to cooperate with responsible, fair-minded organizations or bodies of men in the North or South whenever they publicly announce for districts in which they have known influence policies which we feel justified in accepting as guarantees. Number one, that working and living conditions of Negroes will be fair and decent. Number four, that the Negro will be given fair treatment and be protected in buying and selling. Number five, that the life and property of every Negro will be protected against all lawless assaults. The same level of emphasis and specificity on demands for adequate housing for African Americans did not appear in the League's 1920 annual report. This de-emphasis on housing may have been due to many factors, including a decrease in the rate of migration after World War I, which the Urban League asserted was not as large when the war was on, but remained steady and constant. This assessment of the steady influx of African Americans into Chicago is consistent with that of E. Franklin Frazier in his study Black Bourgeoisie. Frazier asserted that by 1920, the proportion of Negroes in the North had increased to over 14.1%, and 5/6 of those in the North were in cities, principally large cities. The period immediately following the race riot was a period of decline at the Urban League. According to historian Arvera Strickland, the decline was exacerbated by racial apathy and a reduced demand for Negro labor. Although the league continued to ask for financial support for its work to adjust migrants to urban living, migration became increasingly unpopular. Instead of using its female staff workers to assimilate the southern migrants, the league gave out little cards that instructed the migrants about their services and admonished them to be careful of their conduct and habits at home and in public places. This philosophy and methodology of the league in assimilating recent Southern migrants and poor African Americans in public or social etiquette was extended and employed in their efforts to create and maintain respectable and sustainable African-American communities and public places in Chicago. As James R. Grossman points out in his monograph on African-American migration to Chicago, Land of Hope, Chicago, Black Southerners, and the Great Migration, a primary concern during this time period for the Urban League, the Chicago Defender, churches, Chicago's old-timers, and its middle-class African-American community was their constituency not give fuel to the flaming fires of racial stereotyping that justified the use of racial planning and quarantining in the city. Grossman's work revealed that respectable Black Chicagoans recognized that even if they could avoid living among migrants, they would still be associated with them. In cooperation with the Chicago Defender, the leading national African-American newspaper of this period, the League frequently published do's and don'ts for African-Americans that influenced their social construction as environmental undesirables. These included, don't live in unsanitary houses or sleep in rooms without proper ventilation. Don't violate city ordinances relative to health conditions. Don't make yourself a public nuisance. Don't allow yourself to be drawn into street brawls. According to historian Thomas Philpott, the efforts of the League and other Negro uplift organizations to make the Southern migrants more socially acceptable were in vain during this time, since to most residents of white neighborhoods, all Blacks still look like low-grade plantation niggers. Between 1920 and 1924, the Urban League's Civic Department was dissolved. It was reformed in 1925 to 1926 as the Department of Civic Betterment to continue to address the perpetual issue of unsanitary housing and the concomitant environmental and health troubles associated with this problem. Considered by the League to be its outstanding achievement during the period, the department was formed as a standing committee of the League. Its first director and chairperson were women, Maud A. Lawrence and Mrs. Frank Brown. This revised civic department was advised by an interracial civic committee containing 18 members. All but two were women and were all drawn from representatives of the most prominent and politically influential social agencies and organizations in Chicago: the West Side Women's Club, the North Side Community Center, the Neighborhood Improvement and Protective Association, the Chicago Federation of Colored Women's Club, United Charities, the Social Hygiene Council, the Lower North Community Council, the Association of Commerce, the Community Center Council, the Elizabeth McCormick Memorial Fund, the Chicago Women's Club, the Chicago Commons, the Northwestern University Settlement, and the Chicago Council of Social Agencies. The first year efforts of the newly revised department concentrated on civic activities in the areas of thrift, health, recreation, neighborhood clubs, speakers bureau, and participation in a housing conference that had been called by Mary McDowell. In its second year of renewed operation, demands for the League's Department of Civic Betterment increased as a larger than anticipated number of Southern migrants came into the city as a direct result of flooding in the South, as well as the typical problems of high rent and lack of proper housing. The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 was considered to be one of the most threatening natural cataclysms in local history and proved devastating to those living in the Delta, destroying homes, possessions, and crops. The 1926 to 1927 period was a watershed year for the Civic Department. In addition to the unexpected flux of migrants from the South, they began to form new neighborhood clubs and supported the older and existing clubs with speakers. They also began to push clubs' involvement with the city's Neighborhood Improvement and Protective Association. In addition to supporting the development of neighborhood clubs, the department created and implemented three active health committees in the Black Belt that were located on the city's West Side, the Lower North Side, and the Mid-South Side. These committees held a tuberculosis institute in the city's west side at the Hayes School, conducted a series of health lectures in conjunction with a health exhibit on the city's north side, and developed a social hygiene institute on the mid-south side. The activities of these committees were also supported by the city's health department, which lent out health films to neighborhood clubs, schools, and churches, and by the Elizabeth McCormick Memorial Fund. The department also joined with the YMCA, YWCA, the Medical Society, and other health agencies in the city to celebrate the National Negro Health Week in 1927. In addition to all the above activities, in 1926 to 1927, the department conducted several important surveys and studies of day nurseries, of summer camps, and of several neighborhoods. The 1927 annual report for the League declared that the most important neighborhood study embraced the two blocks bounded by 33rd and 35th Streets on Calumet Avenue, and that evidence gathered from the study on 23 homes was presented by the League's executive secretary at the housing conference conducted by the Women's City Club. According to the 1927 annual report, the survey provided an important picture showing the bad housing conditions secured by the Civic Department and used for exhibition purposes. The following year, the Civic Department participated in an all-day housing conference and exhibit at the Women's City Club and held its own conference on housing on March 30, 1928 at the Wabash Avenue YMCA. This was an all-day conference that included a morning session titled Problems of Rehabilitation, an afternoon session, The Relation of Housing and Health, that was led by Dr. Arnold H. Kigel, the city's Commissioner of Public Health, and an evening session, The World's Fair and What It Will Mean to Chicago, that had a special emphasis on the housing situation. The department also went around the city with the Chicago Urban League's own DeVry Motion Picture Machine, conducting health talks with significant films such as Sun Babies for Ricketts and Big Games for Little Babies for talks on tuberculosis. In 1929, the same year that the League completed its two-year study of the Negro family in Chicago, under the direction of E. Franklin Frazier, the department held a morning conference on health and housing that featured Dr. Arnold Kigel as the principal speaker. The conference addressed the health department's plan to demolish housing stock that was a menace to health and good citizenship. Although the 1929 stock market crash on Black Tuesday and the ensuing depression circumvented many organized attempts by African American leaders to effectively deal with environmental inequalities and unsustainable living conditions, their commitment to addressing these issues stayed alive. An article, Hovels or Homes, which appeared earlier that year in the League's Opportunity magazine and was written by Chicago League member Mary McDowell, emphasized that Southern African American migrants in Chicago were being pushed into crowded living conditions that were causing diseases like tuberculosis and crime. McDowell ended her article with a strong recommendation that the City of Chicago's three commissions, the City Plan Commission, the Zoning Commission, and the Housing Commission, all have one slogan: slums must go. Together, we will demolish slum areas and slum houses before 1933. The Chicago Urban League's Civic Department eventually dissolved in 1930 due to a lack of funds and did not function again as a separate department in the League until 1934, after the worst part of the Depression had passed. Like earlier efforts, the League's Civic Department during the Great Depression dealt with the environmental marginalization of a large majority of African Americans in Chicago, who were constricted to living in poor housing stock as a direct result of societal perception that they were agents of blight and undesirables. In its 20th annual report, published in 1935, the League stated that despite the fact that there were no segregation laws in Illinois at the time, the active work in neighborhood improvement associations in the vicinity of Woodlawn, Hyde Park, Inglewood, Oakwood, Kenwood had created a veritable barrier prescribing Negroes within the limits of 22nd to 68th Streets, Cottage Grove to Wentworth Avenues. In the League's 1936 report to the Welfare Council, this racialized geographical reality was cited as the purpose for the recreation of the Civic Department. The League's 1936 report, slightly more specific than its annual report, explicitly stated that the Civic Department had been reinitiated because of the environmental consequences produced by the racially restrictive activities of the Neighborhood Improvement Association in Woodlawn, Hyde Park, Englewood, Oakwood, and Kenwood, which had prevented Negroes from moving into these districts, resulting in the Mid-South Side area becoming very crowded. The reestablishment in 1934 of the Civic Department, now known as the Department for Social and Civic Improvement, was made possible in part by support from Works Progress Administration, WPA, workers, and National Youth Administration workers. The new department was headed by the nationally renowned community organizer, Frazier T. Lane, who had started the League's first block club in Chicago in 1917. Lane came to the Civic Department after having served 6 years as the executive director of the Kansas City Urban League, 4 years as the manager of the People's Finance Corporation, and another 4 years as the activities secretary for Chicago's Wabash Avenue YMCA. A former caseworker for the Cook County Bureau of Public Welfare, Lane began his career in community service with the Chicago League, where he served for 2 years as their activities director. When Lane took over the Civic Department in 1934, with his two assistants, Ms. Juliet Boykins, former club secretary, and Mrs. Florence J. Scott, the League was dedicated to serving more than 200,000 African Americans who were primarily concentrated on the city's south side. Lane continued to focus on the department on neighborhood improvement, but now this goal was to be achieved by setting up block systems as a unit of activity, and then coordinating these systems into a community council that will work to improve their neighborhoods. The new department concentrated most of its efforts on a test area that lay between 47th and 51st Streets and from Cottage Grove to Wentworth Avenues. Prior to initiating its theories on the test area, the League held a two-day conference at which the outstanding problems of the area were discussed by 355 registered delegates from women's clubs, social welfare agencies, public schools, churches, and auxiliary groups. This organizational approach of developing community strength through block clubs was a critical move in the development of the future and successful urban conservation movement. This was also the era that marked the beginnings of beautification campaigns by the League in the African American communities. The beautification campaign successfully increased community-led efforts in planting grass in the neighborhoods and removing eyesores like abandoned cars and trucks for aesthetic purposes. In 1935, the Civic Department declared that out of the 620 front yards in the area, 116 had not been beautified as of August 31st. This shows five times as much grass planted as was true in the past 5 years. These activities were consistent with the League's goals for African American communities, which were to have them develop a common mind on the fact that for many years people are going to be living within this area, and it is up to them to decide on the future value of their property and present moral conditions of their neighborhood. Pamphlets passed out to these communities in this period asked residents to 1. Request landlords to make necessary repairs and to beautify the lawns. 2. Train the children to protect the grass and shrubbery and to refrain from destroying parts of the building. And 7. Insist upon the rigid enforcement of zoning laws. The pamphlets also provided a specific list of conditions that led to blight and slums, including dilapidated houses, dirty streets and alleys, unclean yards, and porches, and piles of junk and rubbish. By the end of the first year of the reestablished Civic Department in 1935, the Urban League reported that they had conducted 159 talks on neighborhood improvement for 3,180 people, had interviewed 1,350 residents and 150 businessmen and public officials in regard to community betterment, and held 16 block club meetings whose average attendance was 14 people per meeting. The end of 1935 also marked the formation of two of the most powerful community clubs in the urban conservation movement, the West Side Community Council and the Washington Park Federation of Neighborhood Improvement Clubs. In addition to working on the test area project in 1936, the Civic Department also conducted two other neighborhood improvement projects, the Community Improvement Project, WPA Project 2526, and the Model Block Experiment. The Community Improvement Project, whose motto was a club in every block in the area, used 145 WPA workers to achieve its objective of improvement, mental, moral, and physical, for the targeted geographical area in cooperation and in conjunction with the Wabash Avenue YMCA. In this case, the targeted area was from 26th Street to 43rd Street and Cottage Grove to Wentworth Avenues. Classes for adults and youths conducted in club settings by the League and the YMCA to foster solidarity and cooperation among residents included sewing, knitting, cooking, health classes, beauty talks, citizenship classes, Negro history, clean blocks, lawn planting, interior decoration, religious education, and dancing. The Model Block Club Experiment Program objectives were similar to that of the League's main test areas, whose emphasis was on the development of civic pride among residents and absentee landlords by keeping the property in good repair, beautifying property by painting buildings, planting grass and flowers, and keeping the neighborhood in such good condition that the value will improve rather than be lessened. This particular project was conducted with interracial cooperation and financial support from the Cecilia Parker Woolley Committee of the Chicago's Women's Club, and focused on buildings on Evans Avenue from 46th to 49th Streets. In 1936, the League also opened up a West Side office branch to deal with similar issues of housing and neighborhood pride. The grim fact of little and extremely poor housing stock for black Chicagoans was espoused before the Chicago Urban League on February 26, 1936, by Harold L. Ickes, U.S. Secretary of the Interior and Administrator of Public Works, who had formerly been the president of the Chicago NAACP. In his address to the League, Ickes announced plans for the development of 47 federal housing projects in the country's larger cities, which would be open to Negroes. According to Ickes, public housing was being built because the Democratic-driven Public Works Program had recognized the wretched living conditions of thousands of Negro families and was undertaking a slum clearance program on the theory that one of the primary needs for a sound democracy is good housing, and in the belief that if our economic system makes it impossible for a large portion of the population to have good housing, there is something wrong with that system. He criticized a legal system that had an ecocentric view towards land use and planning as opposed to a homocentric view when it came to urban redevelopment, lamenting before the Chicago Urban League that the more sustainable housing in the form of public housing for African Americans could have been created. Ickes stated, "There would be many more if the courts had not questioned the right of the federal government to condemn property for housing projects. It seems that under our system, it is permissible to condemn land for wildlife refuge, for parks, for roads, for post offices, and even for courthouses. But some judges are in the opinion that, notwithstanding, the general welfare clause of the federal constitution, we may not condemn fetid, unhealthy, and disgraceful buildings and erect in their place modern, comfortable dwellings for those in the lowest income group. The Chicago Urban League was consistent in voicing its concerns over unsustainable communities for African Americans during the Depression era as a function of racial restrictions. League Executive Secretary A.L. Foster made numerous appearances before civic and political groups to voice the concerns of the organization. On April 5, 1937, Foster gave a speech before the City Club Forum about the conditions of African Americans in the Depression. He articulated in his speech, "The Negro in Chicago and the Depression," that although the main point of the presentation would center on the economic plight of African Americans, all of their problems were rooted in racism. Foster asserted before his all-white audience that the migration between 1910 and 1920 of 750,000 Negroes in 12 urban centers was a problem rendered more acute by the fact that Negroes were segregated. Their dark skins marked them out. Instead of being absorbed as migrating groups sometimes are, they became communities within communities. These concerns were reiterated in a 1938 radio broadcast conducted by Mrs. Irene McCoy Gaines, president of the Chicago and Northern District Association of Colored Women, to mark the 23rd year of service provided by the Chicago Urban League. The broadcast, titled "What the Urban League Movement Means to Chicago," was conducted with Earl B. Dickerson, Attorney General of the State of Illinois and Vice President of the Chicago Urban League, and with A.L. Foster, Executive Secretary of the League. Dickerson and Foster both pointed to racial restrictions as the foundations for poor and unsafe African-American communities in Chicago. Dickerson stated that another contributing factor to our acute housing situation has been the restriction of adjacent property to Negro occupancy, thereby preventing the natural territorial expansion which always accompanies increasing populations. Concurring with Dickerson in the broadcast interview, Foster told the audience that restricted covenants not only prevail in adjacent property, but in other areas and in the suburbs. The congestion in these communities accounts to a large extent for most of the social ills which beset the people in those communities, and the results are undesirable slum areas. The broadcast interview was not meant to be confrontational, but informative, in hopes of invoking the sympathy of their white friends who could help them approach the goal of a better and more inclusive democracy than we have hitherto envisioned. According to Dickerson and Foster, the League's civic department had been formed to address the social ills that naturally accompanied racially segregated neighborhoods. The civic department continued to be aggressive in executing its neighborhood improvement agenda in 1938. With the cooperation of the South Central Real Estate Board, the department launched what newspapers called the most intensive community improvement campaigns ever attempted in Chicago. This campaign, whose motto was, "Your neighborhood and your flat are what you make of them, be proud of them," was clearly environmental in nature and objective. The organizers of the campaign distributed thousands of pamphlets throughout the African-American community that informed residents that they could help improve the environmental quality of their communities if they would help beautify your building and your block by protecting trees, shrubs, and grass, prevent children from playing in halls and vestibules and from marking on walls and woodwork, keep porches, windows, and windowsills free from bottles, rags, and other unsightly objects, properly wrap and dispose of garbage to prevent rats, prevent all kinds of insects by frequenting cleaning of bathrooms, floors, and sinks. In 1938, the League created what will become one of its most critical community councils in the urban conservation movement between 1945 and 1954, the South Parkway Council. The goal of this particular council chaired by Dr. William H. Bumit, was to make Southway Park again the most beautiful boulevard in America. Southway Park Boulevard, formerly known as Grand Boulevard, had beautiful stone homes that became violently contested racial space beginning in 1919 when the home of famous African-American Shakespearean actor Richard B. Harrison was bombed on May 19th of that year. Southway Park Boulevard was also home to the Regal Theater, the largest motion picture house for Negroes in Chicago, as well as a popular place for Negro stage shows. It was also home to the Savoy Ballroom, the largest dance hall for Negroes in America. Even though Southway Park Boulevard had, by the end of the Depression era, became the heart of the Black Belt, drawing thousands to its businesses and entertainment spots and affectionately known as Negro Heaven and the Ivory Coast, it was also fast becoming a slum. As art historian Maren Strange points out in her Photographic History of Chicago's Black Belt, Bronzeville, Black Chicago in Pictures, 1941 to 1943, even these ultra-respectable-looking house fronts in the best area of the Black Belt are merely shells enclosing slum living. The population density here is 70,000 per square mile compared to 34,000 per square mile in equivalent housing in the White District, a couple of blocks away across Cottage Grove. The Southway Park Council's formation was sponsored by the Civic Department, and all of its organizational meetings were attended by the League's Executive Secretary, A.L. Foster, and by the chair of its Civic Department, Frazier T. Lane. In January 1938, the Civic Department published a 10-page report that was clearly written to describe and advocate its own conservation efforts in Chicago's Black Belt, which it stated was physically declining from zoning violations, crime, and vice. According to the report, the department was responsible for the grass planting, cultivation, and beautification in 26 blocks by 1937 in a half-square-mile area, a more than 12-fold increase from the previous 2 years, which had seen only 2 blocks planted in the same area. The department also took responsibility for directly combating slum development by ensuring the reduction of abandoned cars left in the community, 62 cars in 1935, 54 cars in 1936, and 18 cars in 1937. In 1937, the League introduced the Better Block Contest, the precursive conservation contests that motivated the African-American communities to effectively launch the highly successful Block Beautiful contest almost 10 years later. The department stated that the Better Block contest was not an intensive effort, but it was an opportunity for publicity in the local and daily newspapers in which other details of neighborhood improvement plans were set forth. This was also the year that the department promoted the first flower show and neighborhood fair which had ever been conducted in the Negro community in Chicago. The fair was held for 3 days in May 1937 and, according to the department, was well attended. The fair's objectives were to show African Americans in Chicago how to make flowers, gardens, and grass, and how to solve some of the problems which are conducive to the creation of slums. The Civic Department used the fair to introduce members of the community to the concepts of neighborhood improvement clubs and gardening as a hobby, and to showcase beautiful spots on the South Side. The skills learned from the fair made community members more competitive in the Block Beautiful contest. In August 1939, construction began on the first federally funded public housing project for African Americans on Chicago's South Side, the Ida B. Wells Homes. This public housing project was supposed to be the model for sustainable housing for African Americans seeking to escape slum conditions, this legally, racially segregated PWA and eventually CHA housing project was strongly supported by the Urban League in keeping with its advocacy for sustainable housing for African Americans. It proved to be a mixed blessing in the League's drive for sustainable living spaces in the city. The Ida B. Wells homes encountered both technical and legal problems after the land for the property had begun to be acquired in 1936. Most of the legal problems came from the adjacent covenant-protected white communities of Hyde Park, Kenwood, and Oakland, who tried to stop condemnation proceedings by filling demurrers. Urban historian Devereaux Bowerly Jr. notes in his book on subsidized housing in Chicago, The Poor House, that although the Ida B. Wells Homes was the first housing project in Chicago that incorporated a city park within it, the land clearance of former tenement housing sites that was needed for its construction caused additional overcrowding in the black community and increased activity on the part of white neighborhoods to the south in adding restricted covenants to property deeds. The director of the Chicago Urban League's Civic Department, Frazier T. Lane, understood the dilemma of land clearance for both private and public urban redevelopment occurring in the African American community. In 1940, his proposed 10-year plan for Chicago lamented that as old buildings are being torn down, many good buildings are going to ruin for lack of proper care. Good properties are being sold for a song to profiteers. The influential dominant forces of the city are trying to root Negroes out of desirable sections. Since we have no other place to go, and since our children will have to live here, we should purchase a foothold and save the community from destruction and from those who would get rid of us. Lane wanted the African American community to follow the examples of successful ethnic groups who had found sustainable living spaces. He urged the community to forget that we are black and remember only that we are American citizens and responsible for the present and future of the community in which we live in large numbers. Later that year, the Urban League issued a news release dated June 6, which described the accomplishments of its John R. Lynch Model Community Council identified at its June 4th meeting. The news release began by pointing out that the June 4th meeting had begun with an environmental presentation by a Mr. M. Ross of the Chicago Park District. Ross had come to the meeting to encourage citizens to cooperate with the Park District's anti-litter campaign by not littering the boulevards with newspapers, fruit skins, and other debris. The news release also made it clear that the council, which had received strong support from League Civic Director Lane, had made considerable progress since its inception in April 1940. In keeping with the Urban League objectives of grassroots community pride and environmental preservation, not only had the organization developed a 200-person mailing list from residents in the area between 43rd, 47th, Michigan, and South Parkway Boulevard, it had also held a meeting attended by representatives of the Health, Streets, and Alleys, and other public service officials from the City Hall, and also representatives of citywide protective agencies such as the Illinois Vigilant Association. The news release identified 8 improvements that the council had been instrumental in achieving for the impacted communities, including the removal of hideous commercial signs on lawns, the closing down of police stations, the grassing of lawns by summer, and an increase in the number of garbage receptacles. Along with other League-sponsored councils, the Model Community Council continued in 1941 to work at improving the living conditions of African Americans, just as the League's civic director, Frazier T. Lane, continued to emphasize the need to continue these conservation efforts because of unfair housing practices and policies that contributed to the creation of inequitable geographical spaces. In the League's February 1941 news release, A Successful Experiment in Neighborhood Improvement, Lane decried that persistent efforts have been made to blame the present Negro residents for the blight which characterizes the South Central area, but even a casual observer, if he wishes to be fair, would readily understand that this is not true. The area is blighted because restrictive covenants have made it a ghetto with no chance for normal expansion. Apartment buildings have been converted into kitchenettes with the violations of every known building and sanitary code. Streets and alleys have been allowed to go uncleaned, and gambling, especially policy, vice, and crime have been tolerated by the law enforcing bodies. By the time the Ida B. Wells Homes public housing project opened on May 7, 1941, the stereotypical housing for African Americans living on Chicago's South Side was the kitchenette apartment. These apartments were created from larger old homes and apartments that were cut up into smaller units, where a different family would occupy each room, which had a kitchenette installed in it, and a single bathroom shared by several families. On December 7, 1941, the bombing of Pearl Harbor plunged the country into World War II. As the war progressed, the already unsustainable, overcrowded, and inadequate housing conditions were exacerbated with another mass migration of Black Southern migrants to meet the demands of war and post-war economies. The African American population increased from 8% of the city's population, 278,000, prior to the war years to 14% of the population, 492,000, by 1950, and was crowded into almost the same amount of space as in 1940. The dismal housing conditions produced by this second migration fueled the emergence of the urban conservation movement.
Context of white, excuse me, context of white supremacy. So we'll pick up the urban conservation movement, 1945 to 1954. That's what we'll pick up at, and that'll be our last section for the book. The audio was not as clear, and I was greatly disturbed by that. We started a little late because I was trying to figure out what exactly is the problem, because the recording is pristine by all involved. Henry in Chicago has been spectacular the whole time, and yeah, it was put together, uploaded perfectly. I double checked it before, you know, trying to figure out what was happening. And I could not figure that one out at all. I don't know if that's interference, or they said there might be internet problems because so many people are working online with the virus shutdowns and all. But that was peculiar. I guess for people listening to the archives, it won't matter. Only for the people listening live, that was not pleasant. But I think my audio is clear now. We'll try and proceed as best we can. Context of white supremacy, the number 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We'll be wrapping it up today, so if you have concluding thoughts on the text, last things you would like to add in, this would be the time to share, get your thoughts together for our concluding commentary. Just add in again the audio segment that we started off with. That was just from like today, super current, and talking about Chicago, and they mentioned a lot of the same problems. 100 years apart, they're talking about things that were happening in 1920s, 1930s. So 100 years later, that in my view means it could be 2120. And it would be the exact same thing. That is the disgrace of racism, white supremacy, and why there should be some urgency in solving this problem. But they was living in areas with poor ventilation. That's exactly what they said. COVID-19, poor ventilation, diabetes, hypertension, lots of people crammed into these, exactly what they just said. Total, absolute disgrace. And a reminder, because it was messing with me like a little bit, saying, man, are you really going to be on the air broadcasting talking about racism when we got a global health crisis? You're not trying to talk about how people can make ventilators or masks or hand sanitizers or soap, at least, like toilet paper, anything? Like, you're just going to sit on here and keep talking about racism when we got all this happening? When I keep seeing these reports, for, because they said the exact same thing for Louisiana Cancer Alley, like, oh man, we got a whole lot of obese and diabetic people down here, and these are the folks that are going to die. These are the folks who have been dying from this problem. I said, oh yeah, that's why we are on talking. Then today that was backed up. They said, oh man, and the racism too with the testing and all this. I said, oh okay, yeah, that's exactly why we are on. Context of white supremacy. The pandemic is racist man, racist woman, racist child. Folks who dialed in, *61, if you have thoughts, questions, observations. Again, our last time, we have one more audio segment, then we'll be all done. Dr. Sylvia Hood, I have enjoyed the book. Hopefully, if you are a Chicago resident, if you have some connection to Illinois, the Windy City, you should have this book in your library, especially if you are a parent. Absolutely, have it in your library and make sure you read it. They understand it. They might need to, I don't know if you can get this, like, got a 5-year-old or an 8-year-old, maybe need to, you know, be age appropriate with it. But man, if you got children, you live in the Illinois Chicago area, oh yeah, by the time that they should know, by the time I'm 17, like, oh yeah, I'm gonna get my vocabulary together because I'm gonna have to read Dr. Hood's book, Environment Rain. Yeah, I got that one. Okay, and it's probably gonna be Leonita McLean. Make sure you get that one. Whole little library together. Foot in Each World, that's Leonita McLean. Isabel Wilkerson, Warmth of Other Suns, because Chicago is so prominently featured in that book. It should be quite a few. You should not be ignorant about your locale in the system of racism, white supremacy. Getting to it. Let's see. Folks who dialed in with a hand up have our narrator, Henry in Chicago. I'll nab other folks' hands as I see them. Bravo again, professional. Timely effort, getting things done, no excuses, no Chinese virus causing delays, professional job, much obliged. I always hate doing the narrations that have folks who are able to step up and be competent pros at doing the voiceovers. High praise from Gus T. Much obliged, good sir.
All right. Can I be heard?
Crystal clear, yes, sir.
Okay. Gus, you're kind of still choppy, but I mean, I can hear you, but, you know, just to let you know. Gus, will you also be doing the playing the epilogue? Because I send you the epilogue as well.
Gotcha. I'll check my email.
Okay. Yeah. So I send you the epilogue as well. And that's like about, I think I had sent you an email in regards to that because I didn't know if you wanted to do it this week because the epilogue is like a 26-minute recording as well. So, you know, just to let you know about that. But a couple of notes from the recording you just played. You know, I was thinking about the timelines. You know, I'm always thinking about timelines, you know, while I'm reading this book. And 1918, Spanish flu. This was something that I've been looking over the last week or so, you know, because of the fact that, you know, we're going over this COVID-19 thing and how people, you know, handled the Spanish flu. And so I was looking at, you know, some documents from University of Michigan in regards to the Spanish flu in Chicago. And what was interesting was this one article that I pulled up was talking about how more whites had died from the Spanish flu than the African-American population. I think they said 2.7% of the white population were affected compared to 1.4%. And this was some serious stuff with the Spanish flu because there were like, you know, 500 people at the peak of it per day that was dying from this, according to the numbers. And apparently they didn't shut down a lot of things in in Chicago as well until it was like too late. But what was interesting in regards to that discrepancy between whites and African Americans was the commissioner, the health commissioner of Chicago during that time had stated that blacks had an immunity to influenza. And I just laughed at it. But they said realistically, that wasn't the case because the flu, you know, will kill anybody, you know, anybody that's human. But, you know, it didn't really give a clear, clear definition of why more whites died from it than blacks. But I'm attributing it to the, you know, to the racial segregation. I mean, obviously, if blacks are living in different areas than white people, then obviously they're not going to get this flu because they've been more affected with it than the black people. So in some ways or another, actually, racial segregation of areas kind of helped black people in that pandemic with a little less casualties than white people. Elizabeth McCormick mentioned in this text, she's part of the McCormick family, which is named after the McCormick Center, which is a big convention center in Chicago. I think it's the biggest convention center in the country, which will be turned into an emergency center pretty soon, a COVID-19 emergency center. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Two homes that have been demolished that was mentioned in the text, the Icky Homes and the Ida B. Wells Projects, both currently demolished at this time. So that's all I have right now in my life.
Much obliged, Henry, in Chicago. We'll have to see with the timing for the epilogue today, because we did get started a little bit late, but we're on shelter in place, so might not be that big. We could do that, and then we'd be done. That way we wouldn't have to, because that'd be kind of silly to do, like, 20 minutes just for next week or something. We can just be done today. But that is fascinating. Was it with the pandemic, was it that more white people died, was that in Chicago, or more white people died throughout the country?
According to the article I read, it was just Chicago.
Okay. That is interesting. Now they brag about that almost. Like, to this day, Chicago's like the most what they call segregated city, so could have been like a kind of a quarantine in effect, but they did say that they had the vice area where they would come for the, you know, prostitution and gambling. So, but that is interesting. That's one to ponder on. Was the so-called segregation that good that they were effectively quarantined from getting the illness? Let's see. Thomas in New York, if other folks have a thought on that or their own notes as we kind of cruise towards the conclusion of packing them in. Thomas in New York, thoughts?
In particular on what Henry just said, I didn't know too much about the racial breakdown of the Spanish flu. But I will say that this current coronavirus, it seems like it's only in the areas where you have a lot of black people right now. It's in Baltimore, Chicago, Detroit, New Orleans, all the chocolate cities, Atlanta, it's already in New York, you know, so now here in Chicago, you know, so it seems like it's targeting one group of people right now, even though it didn't start out that way. What I wanted to talk about from the reading was, when I grew up in Jersey City, we used to have what we called the Block Association. And they used to talk about these different block clubs. And they said, oh, this sounds like the Block Association, you know, where they would have like a toll bank and everyone in the area, you know, they bring their telephone bill or something to prove that they live in the area. They could borrow the tools at a maybe a discounted price, or it might have been free even. I can't even remember. But all of those organizations didn't help our condition at all. And it still didn't give us a community. Like, say, this is your community where you guys can make the rules, and determine what goes on here. It was just, you know, you guys, the whole house decoration contest, and, you know, just little minute thing that, and it was sort of like you have an area where you're just trying to change the aesthetic, but nothing else in the area. Just make it look better, you know. It's like, you know, putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. You know, it's not going to really, it's going to stop the bleeding for a little while and, you know, make it at least look like you're not bleeding, but you're still, you know, still in the worst conditions that you could possibly be. So I just thought that was interesting. And I knew my mom, Gus, but it was a lot of different organizations and leagues and clubs that were mentioned and what they were responsible for. Then you look at present day Chicago, and it was like, well, that was just a waste of money. Waste of time.
It's a waste of time. Thomas in New York, much obliged. It's a waste of time. Other folks, if you have comments, questions, *61, I'll keep an eye out on the switchboard. One of our listeners, investors, wrote in. He says, number one, from the last reading, the 1939 Supreme Court case Lee versus Hansberry is discussed. The Hansberry refers to the father, Carl, of the playwright Lorraine Hansberry, cowbell, author of the celebrated play Raisin in the Sun, featuring Ruby Dee the first time around. And all you did, guess who's coming? Sidney Poitier, yes, Raisin in the Sun. Classic. Classic, set in Chicago. Disgraceful. I'll talk about that later. After she and her family moved into the house in the white neighborhood at the center of the case, the white neighbors terrorized the family to the point that her parents carried pistols. Woo! I wonder if the terroristic acts of these racists had been incorporated into her play, if it would have garnered the same. Come on. That's why it's so important. I didn't know that about her parents, that this play, Raisin in the Sun, which is famous, they've done so many different versions of it. They showed Diddy this week, Mr. Sean Combs. He is in one of the more recent versions of Raisin in the Sun, because they just keep doing it over and over and over again. But he was in one of the more recent versions of it. I saw him this week. They were showing different celebrities and how they're dealing with, you know, the quarantine. Anyway, this play, it is about a black, talk about blackness, Andrew. This play, which has been celebrated for the last 70 years, is basically this black male drunkard who lives with his mother and has a job. He's like a chauffeur for white people. And shiftless black male. His father dies, and they get his life insurance policy, and so they get like $10,000 for his life insurance policy. His mother wants to save this money, invest a little bit in her daughter's college, and, you know, get them a house. See if they can get a house to move out to where the white people live in Chicago. They live in this no-count, you know, dingy little shack. And so he wants to buy a liquor store, the main character, who's played by Sidney Poitier, is one of his breakout roles early in his career. And so she gives him money, the money to invest. She wants him to invest some in the liquor store and then save part for the house and for her daughter's college. And he ends up investing it all in the liquor store. And another black male runs off with all of the money, and so they're left, you know, in poverty and hating this no-count black male who's, you know, giving away all their money. And they end up moving out to the white neighborhood anyway. That's the, you know, the happy ending, is that even though they lost all the money, we're still going to move out to where the racists who don't even want them, like, they come out in a really nice, like, please don't come out here. Now, if they had included that in the play, that things were so bad that her parents had to end up carrying pistols to be out there, like, wow, what a colossal tragedy. But that's not the way it's viewed. It's, you know, bravo. It's best. Anyway, yeah, that's why it's so important to read history so that you know more of the details as best you can about what actually happened, because so many details are obscured. And that's a painful cowbell, Lorraine Hansberry. Woo! Continuing. Near the end of his life, he was so disaffected by the racism in the U.S., this is Lorraine Hansberry's father, he made plans to move his family to Mexico. While visiting Mexico, he had a stroke and died. John Henryism, medical apartheid, again, the plague on the planet, racist man, racist woman, racist child. Number two, the text describes the concerns of Chicago's black old-timers about assimilating southern migrants. These distinctions are reminiscent of the distinctions that are made between so-called native U.S. blacks, descendants of U.S. chattel slavery, and those who immigrate from the Caribbean and Africa by non-white victims. Woo! Mm. Further in the text, historian Thomas Philpott summarized the folly of this distinction. To most white residents of white neighborhoods, all blacks still look like low-grade plantation niggers, in quotes. Make it plain. Make it plain. Make it plain. We got niggers, and we got respectable niggers. We got dignified niggers. We got clowning niggers. We got selling niggers. We got singing niggers. We got lots of different niggers, but niggers is still niggers. That is the most important thing to remember. Number three, I found it interesting that the suspected racist Herbert L. Ickes? I've never even seen this before. We got Ickes. I'm going to go with that one. Ickes, U.S. Secretary of Interior, was formerly president of the Chicago chapter of the NAACP. His son Harold was chief of staff of policy for President William Jefferson Clinton. Talk about the cronyism. Harold was a civil rights activist during the 1960s and took part in Freedom Summer. He is a credentialed white man. And I mean, that is major cronyism. But I mean, that's par for the course system of white supremacy. Number four, I was struck by the dizzying array of organizations discussed in the chapter. Thomas in New York said that. NAACP, Urban League, organizations within organizations, book club movement, Department of Civic Improvement, the John R. Lynch Model Community Council, West Side Women's Club, North Side Community, North Neighborhood Improvement and Protective Association. I went to the United Independent Compensatory Code System concept word guide regarding organizations. Those white persons of the known universe who have chosen to practice white supremacy racism are the most organized people in the known universe. During the existence of white supremacy racism, and according to compensatory counter-racist logic, it is not possible for victims of white supremacy, non-white persons, to organize as a group against white supremacy racism. While subject to white supremacy and according to counter-racist code of thought, speech, and action, non-white people of the known universe can only organize as individual persons. Very important. Talking about that four-wallism concept. And a lot of these organizations, Mr. Fuller was a member of the NAACP, and he got to watch a lot of these organizations. That's how he came to this conclusion. Like, I bet if you called him and asked him, like, are you familiar with, and just started reading the names, say, well, I got a NAACP card, and Urban League, yep. Like, that's how I bet he would say something close to that. That's how I came to my conclusion about Four Wall. I sat there and watched all of this for a number of years, and boop, what you just read, that is my conclusion. Neely Fuller Jr., producejustice.com. Our investor, he concludes, I'm going to recommend this book to any black person I know who currently resides or is considering living in Chicago. Absolutely. Got to have this in your library. If you have any connection at all, even if you don't live there, I wouldn't care if you said you lived in Japan now. If your parents are what they call from Chicago, that's where they were born and what have you, that had a formative impact on who they are and all that, oh yeah, you should have this book. This book will probably tell you a whole lot about you. Because I was even thinking, like, reading all that about these beautiful block contests and everything, and then, like, when Dr. Welsing was born, I said, man, Dr. Welsing probably saw some of this stuff. Like, man, I wish I would have, like, man, did you see these beautiful block contests and beautiful neighborhood context? Because she, when I kept hearing this, I kept hearing like a faint little whisper of, every black person should have an A+ in broom. I said, man, that is, I bet Dr. Welsing, saw some of this stuff. It's no way, this would have had to have been going on. I mean, these are the years we're talking about. This is when she was growing up, 40s in Chicago. Yeah, I think she would have seen some of this stuff. I could be wrong, but I think she would have seen some of this. I think that might have even had a direct impact on A+ and, but not that I'm knocking it at all. I mean, hey, clean up. That's what they're saying, right? Wash your hands. That's what they're saying right now. No problem with that at all. That's great. Being about being clean and sweeping up and making sure that where black people live is not synonymous with trash. But, yeah, and I also, when I was hearing this, was thinking a lot of what they call respectability politics. When they were talking about listener who wrote in, they were talking about the black people who maybe they migrated to Chicago a few years earlier, and so then the next generation or the next wave of black people relocate to Chicago. Oh, my God, where did these, Negroes come from? The country, nope. Trifling niggers and look at what they're wearing, and you got to get out of here, man, and they're gonna mess it up for everybody. So we got one group of niggers and a different group of niggers. Niggers are still niggers. But they said we're gonna have these campaigns, we got to go and show them the proper way to be and where to put trash. And not that I'm knocking cleanliness, but a lot of that sounded like respectability politics. That is the best quote in the whole book. To most white residents of white neighborhoods, all blacks still looked like low grade plantation niggers, period. And that's all direct quote. That is all you need to know about racism, white supremacy, because that does come up over and over. That was in Warmth of Other Suns as well. Black people getting upset at the new niggers that come in and rile things up, and they're loud. And that was in New York too. That was in lots of different cities where that sort of thing, Yeah. Let's see. What are some of my other notes from the chapter? Respectability politics and the lots of words. Okay, let's see. It said as early as 1917, the League, this is the Urban League, began utilizing African American women to do their block work, which entailed going into the homes of newly arriving migrants and giving them advice about health, cleanliness, deportment in public spaces, care of children, overcrowding, and efficiency. there's lots of, to me, this just reeks of respectability politics. This is not, hey, black brother, I'm so glad to have you in the Windy City, and we got a pamphlet, and these are all the cool spots to go, and if you need information about blah, 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 and looking out for you, and, come over, we want to have that. That does not sound like what this is like at all. This sounds kind of patronizing, you dumb SOBs don't know anything, and you're just going to mess it up for everybody, so we need to kind of help you out as best you can so you don't get us all in trouble with white people, realizing you're already in trouble. Let's see, what else did I have? Respectability politics. So they come with their list of do's and don'ts. Don't live in unsanitary houses or sleep in rooms without proper ventilation. Now, if I live in, because they would go in and chop up a residence that was built, designed for one family, and they would chop it up and put four black families in it, and then charge them each five times what the property is worth. So if I'm in this spot and it doesn't have any windows, what in the 1930s, what am I to do for ventilation? And then am I to be blamed because I live in this space that doesn't have any ventilation? Is that my fault? And then particularly, they won't allow me to live any place, I'm restricted in terms of where I can live, right? So is that my fault on the list of do's and don'ts? It says don't violate city ordinances relative to health conditions. Now, again, if I live in a residence that doesn't have a fire trap, a fire exit, doesn't have proper ventilation, I'm violating the do's and don'ts. But is that my fault? Then don't make yourself a public nuisance. I'm not sure what that means. Sometimes just being a black, you're being classified as black, you're considered a nuisance. Don't allow yourself to be drawn into street brawls. Now, I cracked up laughing on this one. Now, hey, I'm all for not being in conflict with other non-white people, but I cracked up laughing. Like, didn't they just have, like, black people being bombed? Like, I thought I just read that. I was going to say that. Like, for this book that's supposed to be about environmental racism, like, I feel like we read a whole lot about white people bombing black people. Like, it came up over and over and over and over. White people bombing black people, like not black agency, not black people. I feel like I heard way more examples of white people bombing black people than black people like getting together and successfully getting like Bubbly Creek rectified or Altgale Gardens cleaned up, or you know, they got the butcher companies to move and slaughter their cattle elsewhere. Like, it's a whole lot of fails on that, but it's a whole lot of examples in this book throughout of white people bombing black people. Let's see, in Chicago, no less, like, not in, you know, not that it's anything peculiar about white people bombing black people, but in Chicago, like, I don't think that's, like, if somebody said white people bombing black people, I don't think Chicago would be a top spot that would pop in the people's, like, list. Give me 10 cities that are notorious for bombing black people. I don't think Chicago is going to be on a whole lot of people's top 10, even top 15 list. Chicago. Let's see. So this is the following year, the Civic Department participated in an all-day housing conference and exhibit at the Women's City Club and held its own conference on housing on March 30th, 1928. Some of this is getting close to Mr. Fuller's birth date. At the Wabash Avenue YMCA, this was an all-day conference that included a morning session titled Problems of Rehabilitation and an afternoon session, The Relation of Housing and Health, that was led by Dr. Arnold H. Kegel, the city's Commissioner of Public Health, and an evening session, The World's Fair and What It Will Mean to Chicago, that had a special emphasis on the housing situation. All of this, and they go on to break down specific talks about health habits with black people and the Chicago's Urban League being involved. White people are not ignorant. Like I said, some of this is exactly what they're talking about today. April 2, 2020. This is exactly what they're talking about with COVID-19 right now, and why Chicago, Cook County, is a hot spot for the virus. You got people that live in bad health conditions and poor ventilation. It's exactly what they're talking about. They're not ignorant. This is not, oh, we just did a report in March, and man, it's terrible to be in these. They have known this for a long time. They don't care. These niggers, we intend for you niggers to be in places with poor ventilation and toxins everywhere, and pollution, and bad food. That's the goal of all of it. We designed it that. We've been planning this for centuries. Let's see. The fella here, we moved down. This is 169. On April 5, 1937, 100 years, Foster gave a speech before the City Club Forum about the conditions of African Americans in depression. He articulated in his speech The Negro in Chicago and the Depression that although the main point of the presentation would center on the economic plight of African Americans, all of their problems were rooted in racism, still true 100 years later. Foster asserted before his all-white audience, now I will say that alone, give out his full name, A.L. Foster. 1937? And it's almost, I'm too ignorant to do the math, but that's about, what is that, 80, about 77 years? We're almost 77 years to the date of this speech, April 5? Like, wow. But, I mean, to do this in an all-white audience in 1937? Wow. That is at least worth a handshake. Like, I don't know if I would be all out of, black brother, Foster, that is a, but wow, like, he could have been killed, I think. 1937? I just said, we just read a book that featured a lot of white people bombing black people. Like, I think he could have been killed. Like, somebody easily could have been, we got a sassy nigger here. What do you mean? Are you saying white people are to blame for all the black? Is that what you're saying? And that could have been that, like 1937? Oh, yeah, he could have been killed, I think, for doing, even if they killed him on the spot right there, or they could have waited a few days and killed. Like, this is like 20 years before Emmett Till was even killed. Like, yeah, I think he could have been. Dr. King said Chicago's the worst place. They were waiting in trees for him. That was 30 years later. Anywho. Yeah, these block campaigns. This is, Dr. Welsing had to see some of this. It's no way. All of that, like I said, I'm not disparaging it. It's great. I'm going to clean up a little bit just in thinking of her. I'm going to clean up a little bit around the house once the program is done. All of that said, I think that is direct influence from this. I think she would have had to see some of these events and things happening when she was a little girl in Chicago. There's no way she could have missed it. And that would have had to have impacted her brain computer. What is it? Let's see. So with cooperation of the South Central Real Estate Board, the department launched what newspapers called the most intensive community improvement campaigns ever attempted in Chicago, which Dr. Welsing would have seen. This campaign, whose motto was "Your neighborhood and your flat are what you make them, be proud of them," were clearly environmental in nature and objective. The organizers of the campaign distributed thousands of pamphlets throughout the African American community that informed residents that they could help improve the environmental quality of their communities if they would help beautify your building and your block by protecting trees, shrubs, and grass. And then he goes on, keep your children from that. Properly wrap and dispose of garbage to prevent rats and all the rest of it. If you live somewhere that is a fire trap, that is overcrowded, these things may help a little bit. But it's not really going to get to the root of the problem, nor is it going to make this environment any safer. In a number of ways, it's not going to improve the ventilation. It's not going to stem the overcrowding. Because it's overcrowded, it's probably going to have too much trash because it's not a space that was designed to have that number of occupants. So it's really not going to address any of the problems, the root of which is white people. And why are so many of us stuffed into this area? And why are they so deliberately inconsistent with sanitation and building maintenance and enforcement of codes and all the rest of it? Beryl Satter, her book, Family Property, 2015, in the archive, she goes into lots of detail about Chicago specifically, exclusively, and her father was one of the white owners of these properties and was trying to call attention to all of these problems, white people being to blame. This is not just our place is dirty and that sort of thing. This is like fire traps, and you have a fire and like 20 people die all at once, children, everything. It's not just, you know, your place is bad or I don't like it and I get to shake my finger. Like, this is like, no, people die as a result of that. Same thing that they're saying right now with COVID-19. Get one more in. What is this here? I forgot. Lost my mind why I made this a note. I'll read it and see if it jogs my memory. It says, South Parkway Boulevard, formerly known as Grand Boulevard, had beautiful stone homes that became violently contested racial space beginning in 1919 when the home of famous African-American Shakespearean actor Richard B. Harrison was bombed. Oh, that's on cue. Yes, that's why I took a note of that. Was bombed on May 19 of that year. South Parkway Boulevard was also home to Regal Theater, the largest motion picture house for Negroes in Chicago, as well as a popular place for Negro stage shows. It was also home to Savoy Ballroom, the largest dance hall for Negroes in America. The dance hall bits, like, I guess they didn't have a problem making a place for black people to go and cut loose and cut some rug, they say. Dr. Welsing would say, we need to stop being known for dance. If we start a dance, it'll be around the world. I guess that would be a reason why. White people, no problem. You want a dance hall? No problem. We'll build you the biggest dance hall in the world. Library? Healthy housing? Clean water? You want us to stop dumping pollution and poison on you? Yeah. We gotta think about that. But if you want another dance hall, we got you. We got you. Boy, we love to see you all cut a rug. I'll stop. I did have other notes, but I'll stop there. Somebody mentioned Ida B. Wells this week, and I was not pleased. Lots of people got on my nerves this week, so it's not no big deal. Other folks have commentary they wanted to get to before we get to second audio segment. They just
Can I bear it?
Narrator, Henry in Chicago.
Yeah, you know, last week you asked about if I knew anybody who knew about the bombings in Chicago. I had to get off early last week. My apologies for that. But my dad had mentioned it to me after I asked him the question about it when I read about it. Like, my dad had, he talked to me about a lot of historical stuff. But yeah, the bombing was one of the ones that I had to ask him about. And he said he didn't know anybody who got bombed, but he has heard about it. My family moved here to Chicago. My grandfather moved here from Mississippi in around late 1930s, and they moved in a small area of Morgan Park, where there was a small group of black people, where white people allowed black people to live at. And what was so interesting is my dad wanted to go to DuSable High School, which where majority of the black people lived at. It's in that area that the book is talking about. I think it's on Wabash Avenue. And my grandfather had told him he had to go to Morgan Park High School, which was at the time 98% white. And so my father wasn't too happy about that. But what my grandfather said was he wanted him to go to Morgan Park because that was the real world. He said, eventually, you're going to have to deal with white people, and this is what you're going to have to deal with. So my father at first didn't like it, but then when he experienced the racism and the terrorism that he had told me about, he understood it a lot better, what my grandfather was trying to attempt him to realize when he got out into the world. So, but I think I had something else, but I'll save it for later. But that's all I have.
This is the real world, and the folks who are in charge of that real world. Absolutely. Dr. Welsing, born March 1935. March 1935. Chicago native. Absolutely. She would have been, like I said, her formative years, being a little girl with these, better neighborhoods and most beautiful block campaigns and such. She would have been growing up and seeing this. That sounds, if anybody here who heard Dr. Welsing when she said that, I would have found it. I would have went through and tried to see if I could dig out one where she, because she included that in the 10 stops, get an A in every black person should have an A in broom, in sweeping, no throwing down trash where black people live. That sounds exactly like these better block. Not at a bad, I'm not, again, not criticizing. I'm just saying, like, wow, that sounds like probably influenced. I can see how that, boop, 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 include that right in a constructive way. No criticism at all. Anybody else? Comment?
Yeah. Thomas, can I say something, Gus?
Yes, sir.
People that are alive, probably listening to the show or the archive, from Chicago that were alive when they built the project, and were alive when they knocked them down. They did it within their lifetime, like what, they 30, 40, 50 years spent. They spent all this money, all this labor, all this time invested in planning and dealing with covenants to get these projects built all throughout Chicago. And within the swoosh of a pen, they all just disappear, and, I mean, you just talk about how, the power white people want just to put that much emphasis on something that I'm sure they knew when they built them. Nah, this could be here 15, 16 years. That was nothing to them, it's just the dedication they have to keeping us in the situation that we currently in. That was by design, these are the first public housing developed for Negroes. They even spoke the law to make it so no one else can move here but Negroes. And also the black people was just like, yes, we got something of our own. And it's like, no, within their lifetime, these things are gone. Just the psychological effect that might have on someone who invested their time and effort into getting this thing done just, with, you know, within their lifetime to see it all just go away. You know what I'm saying?
That is the system of racism. They are very effective building things up, and particularly building things up that, as you said, that you can put a lot of time and energy. A lot of times these, we'll read some of that, you know, as we go towards the stretch, but them fighting tooth and nail to get these projects together and having to grapple for every nail and bit of land, and then they build it, and it still doesn't solve the problem of white supremacy racism, and then like that, whammo, torn all down, and we still haven't got the problem solved of adequate housing. Black people are starting to leave the city of Chicago, and they still don't have the problem of adequate housing solved. Or Bubbly Creek. Let's see. Other folks dialed in, comments, questions to add. Let's see. Our caller in Canada should be with us. Did you have commentary or questions?
Yes, sir. I'd just like to add to what you're saying about the PhD in broom studies. Yes, that's what I was thinking when I was reading, when I was listening to the text. And then also when Thomas in New York was talking about how, you know, how they like to, well, all of us are talking about how we, the white supremacists build things up. And then when it gets to be all good and then we're enjoying it, once we're all enjoying it, then they just remove the carpet from underneath our feet and then we're back to where we were. And, yeah, so that's the same kind of a thing that seems to always happen.
Yep. They repeat a lot of similar behavior patterns, system of white supremacy. Build things up to tear it down. Wait until you're enjoying it, and then whammo, snatch it right out from underneath you. I guess, yeah, because we got to get to it. I'll just save the rest of it for later on. I'll see how the time goes, how we can manage getting the epilogue in as well, so we can be totally, totally done with Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington's packing them in. But we will get to audio segment number two. We're picking up on the section, The Urban Conservation Movement, 1945-1954. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment two.
The Urban Conservation Movement, 1945 to 1954. Civil rights historians like Nancy J. Weiss have argued that the National Urban League was not a civil rights organization at its inception in 1910. Rather, Weiss feels that the League was a social service agency dedicated to advancing the social and economic conditions of blacks in the cities that left the businesses of political and civil rights to its counterpart, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP. Much of the research for this book, however, contradicts Weiss' assertion, especially when one looks at the League's urban conservation movement that occurred from 1945 to 1954. Through its various departments, such as the Civic Education Department, the League had always addressed what we refer to today as sustainability issues. In the face of the second migration, which in sheer numbers was much greater than the first, African Americans decided to make the best of what they perceived to be an exponentially deteriorating environmental geographical space. The urban conservation movement was seen by African American leaders as a critical effort in the civil rights struggle for Chicago's African American community. Restricted covenants, and the resultant housing dilemmas were the primary civil rights issues at the time. As well, the continued existence of legal restricted covenants immediately after the war fueled a new crisis as the concomitant environmental problems associated with crowded living conditions, tuberculosis, rat attacks, and house fires reached crisis levels. In a March 4, 1947 letter to the National Urban League Executive Secretary, Lester B. Granger, Sidney R. Williams, Executive Secretary of the Chicago Urban League, declared that Chicago's most urgent immediate problem is housing and urged a formal plan of action that would get aldermen with all or large Negro constituents to have the city appropriate sufficient funds to subsidize the cleaning up of the buildings and alleys. In turn, that would, get the householders completely sold on the idea to such a degree that they will become a political force of the first magnitude. Williams also pointed out that Chicago's proposed civic program would in no way detract from the current struggle against restricted covenants. Rather, it would support it. Moreover, pending the day when forced racial ghettos are a thing of the past in Chicago, it is desirable that Negro people live in healthier and more inspringing surroundings, if no other reason than for their children's sake. At the time of the urban conservation movement began, racial tensions in Chicago were high. Housing demands had increased significantly due to the large number of returning war veterans. Restricted covenants were in effect and were being legally and violently enforced. Chicago Mayor Dwight H. Green had appointed Judge Leonard C. Reed, who openly supported and had signed restricted covenants, to the circuit court. The front headlines for the Chicago Defender on March 10, 1945 were, "Hoodlums attack two homes," and "Governor Green slaps Negroes, named race-hating judge." The article about the race-based residential violence reported that white residents in the Inglewood area had thrown a stench bomb into the home of a young African-American couple and then, several hours later, had thrown bricks at the home of an African-American war worker. According to African-American historia Arvera Strickland, there were at least nine major riots in Chicago between 1945 and 1954, and between 1948 and 1951, there were 217 reported attacks against property. This was, as Chicago historian Christopher Reed concludes, a period of racial terrorism. The movement was initially driven by the Chicago Urban League's five-year plan of 1945. The plan was, in fact, an expansion of the League's existing civic department made possible by financial support from the Community Fund. The five-year plan was, in essence, a plan to help create sustainable, economically, socially, and environmentally, communities for Chicago's migrating rural African Americans. Each year of the five-year plan was to be focused on some specific aspect of Negro life, like household management, child rearing, civic responsibilities, and basic problems. The plan was developed by a 17-member interracial citizens committee that included League President Earl B. Dickerson, Rabbi Louis Binstock, League Vice President Theodore K. Lawless, Judge George L. Cullisai, Sarah Southall, A.A. Sprague, and Robert R. Taylor. Its objectives were twofold. First, to educate the Negroes to their own rights as citizens, and second, to help them to make a better adjustment to city living. Public consciousness about the continuing struggle for equal access to viable housing was well developed when the five-year plan was published in local newspapers. Editorials by readers of The Defender included "Cleanliness Key to Better Housing" and "Urges Negroes to Help Themselves," and spoke to the need for African Americans to optimize their living spaces since they had little chance of escaping into better and cleaner spaces. In the spring of 1945, one Defender reader asked in an editorial, "Do you think we could get or rent flats or homes in better neighborhoods if we were cleaner and more progressive in the homes we now live in?" Within 2 weeks of that publicized question, on May 5, 1945, Bronzeville Mayor Dr. James M. Scott issued a cleanup creed that was published in The Defender. The mayor's creed was clearly an environmental and public health proclamation, calling on all South Sides to aid in the 1945 cleanup drive sponsored jointly by the Board of Education, Park District, and the Association of Commerce. The proclamation urged citizens to participate in the program because the coming of spring will bring about the renewal of disease breeders endangering community life. A few shabby, unsanitary properties and rags on the streets are conducive to disease, reduce adjacent property values, and menace public health and safety. And rats and insect pests detrimental to the general safety and well-being of our children must be completely exterminated. Less than 3 months after the release of the five-year plan, the NAACP organized a 3,000-person protest and march against restricted covenants confining Negroes to present Southside boundaries. The protests included speeches denouncing the problems from a diverse array of speakers that included Alderman William H. Harvey of the 2nd District, where the vast majority of African American lives, Bernice Fisher, the NAACP delegate, who had recently represented the organization in a restricted covenant hearing on a bill before the Illinois legislature, State Representative A.E. Sykes, Oscar Brown, president of the Chicago NAACP branch, and Ishmael P. Flory, former CIO union organizer. The urban conservation movement launched by the five-year plan was not simply an educational drive or awareness campaign. It was a well-organized action that consisted of letter-writing campaigns and town meetings for blocks, neighborhoods, and multiple communities that brought them together with public agencies and officials to protest the horrific conditions. It was also a grassroots movement that promoted and supported regular meetings of citizens. A more expansive definition of the plan was elucidated by the League in a High Neighbor leaflet that was distributed across African American communities in 1946. The leaflet detailed 9 goals of the plan. The first was to lead the people of the community to become conscious of the existence of their communities as such and of the significance of the community as a basic unit of civilization and to encourage them to feel that they are members of it. This first objective, like the entire project, was aimed at re-enfranchising African Americans as members of communities so that they could create or sustain viable living environments as a unified neighborhood. These aims were clearly identified by the 2nd through 4th stated aims of the plan. 2. To satisfy unmet needs, whether economic, cultural, or physical. 3. To incline the people of the community to plan and act together for common ends and for development of common acquaintances and interests so that there will be all-around participation in the thinking, the feeling, and the activities of the group. 4. To develop a community spirit and common community standards and to maintain them in a spirit of loyalty. Through its civic department and then the community organization department, the Chicago Urban League held leadership training workshops that taught citizens how to demand city services and how to implement conservation programs for their communities. This effort was consistent with the five-year plan's goal to promote civic education and responsibility among African Americans in Chicago. By the end of 1945, the expanded Civic Education Department had secured the signatures of 1,500 Southside citizens who pledged their support of and participation in the five-year plan. In its 1945 annual report, the League pointed out that the home and neighborhood problems identified by the communities were being solved by the people themselves, and that community resources had also been organized for these communities. The year 1945 also marked a change in the artwork used by the League in emphasizing its mission. For the first time, the cover page of the annual report showed contrasting pictures of poor living conditions and optimal housing under the banner for all, regardless of race, creed, or color, health, surroundings, good housing. In 1946, exactly 1 year after the release of the five-year plan, the League provided summary reports about the community efforts in its High Neighborhood leaflet in the West Washington Park, DuSable, and Snowdonville areas and for the John R. Lynch Model Community Project. The leaflet shared stories about grassroots and individual efforts to achieve sustainable living spaces like the One Good Neighbor in Washington Park, who had become weary of pleading with her landlord for a garbage can, piled the garbage on her third floor porch until there was a big heap. Then she proceeded to call the health department. Enough said. Every flat in the building now enjoys garbage cans furnished by the Chastidon landlord. By the end of 1946, the league claimed that it was trying to meet the needs of between 350,000 to 400,000 African Americans in Chicago. The Civic Education Department reported that it had received almost double the number of residents' signatures in support of the plan, 2,572 pledge cards signed in 1946 versus 1,500 in 1945. The Civic Department also stated in its 1946 report that it had made 341 agency visits, held 390 meetings divided between five African-American neighborhoods on the south side of Chicago, and had organized 97 blocks to promote grassroots activities supporting sustainable communities, and that its neighborhood secretaries had conducted 5,773 personal interviews in the community. The Civic Department also reported its activities for the west side of Chicago in 1946. Although the African-American population on the west side was smaller than that on the south side, the department reported that it had conducted 678 personal interviews, received 1,932 telephone calls, and held 262 group meetings at the league's West Side Center. This was also the same year that 10 active blocks organized into a neighborhood improvement council on the west side and conducted 75 meetings in 1 year. The league felt that the work of the Civic Department in 1946 was pivotal to the welfare of Chicago's African-American communities because, according to League Executive Secretary A.L. Foster, the citizens were overcrowded in areas which are neglected all too frequently by municipal services, denied many of the rights and privileges of American citizenship, frustrated and discouraged. In its 1947 annual report, the League published for the first time its philosophy and strategy. The League would state that in light of the enormous influx of African Americans into the city of Chicago, it was its task to assist the city in absorbing this huge post-war migration of African Americans and to aid the newcomers in becoming an integral part of the metropolitan area by minimizing the difficulties arising from race prejudice and by developing the best possible interrelation of the white and colored population. The three major program areas for the league featured on the front page of the 1946 report were industrial, race relations, and civic education. In 1947, the Civic Department was renamed the Community Organization Department and articulated three areas of concern: race relation, social welfare, and community organization. Only the last two focus areas, however, were to be addressed by the department, still emphasizing that the department and the league were dealing with abysmal living conditions produced by the crowding of 380,000 people into areas planned to accommodate one-third of that number. The 1947 annual report highlighted its activities with block organization and the progress of the Block Beautiful contest it was promoting with the Chicago Defender. Even with one less neighborhood secretary, from five in 1946 to four in 1947, the Community Organization Department reported that they had interviewed or talked with 4,123 individuals to interest them in joining one of 96 block organizations or in forming a block unit in their own block. By the end of 1947, the department reported that it had three active neighborhood councils who were holding annual banquets with total attendance of 300 people. It had also conducted a homemakers workshop aimed at improving housekeeping practices as well as a co-op food buying demonstration to protest high prices. The Community Organization Department made it clear that block units on the city's south side were identified as such only after areas were divided into natural sections and then into blocks. Once the block units were formed, they were then drawn into a neighborhood council for cooperative attack on common problems. It was in these small units that the citizens learned the responsibility of working towards the democratic ideal and improving his own usefulness to the community. The department continued its work on the west side, where the African American population had grown to almost 40,000. These efforts were directed towards meeting and supporting the largely environmental needs of that area's Community Improvement Council. The needs identified in the 1947 report for the West Side were the extermination of rats, elimination of storage boxes in windows, cleaned up yards, porches, basement, and removal of old dilapidated billboards and prostitutes off the streets. The motto for the Chicago Urban League's 1948 annual report was American Teamwork Works. The cover page featured a photograph of two Cleveland Indian baseball players, Larry Doby, an African-American player, and Steve Gromick, a white player, were hugging each other and had large, toothy smiles on their faces, epitomizing mutual acceptance. Using the analogy of team spirit and teamwork, the report began with an admonishment and a warning that interracial strife and dissension in Chicago and in America would cause both city and country to forfeit the game of democracy by striking out. On the second page of the report, the league pointed out that the northern type of exclusionism Negro citizen players suffer in Chicago gives rise to a body of demoralizing attitudes among the badly coached elements of both our white and Negro rookies. The poor racial attitudes of badly coached white rookies, according to the league, had been absorbed by altogether too many first-generation white citizen players, which seemed to cause them to believe that the acquisition of a strong anti-Negro bias is the first base they must reach to qualify to become good, respectable Americans. The report gave a listing of negative racial attitudes that the league felt were contributing to the city's and the country's forfeiture of democracy. Among these were included the frequently opined, "Let's run or burn them out, else our property will lose its value," from a white neighborhood protective association. The aggressiveness of the 1948 report was unprecedented and no doubt reflected the league's confidence to openly attack racial segregation based on that year's U.S. Supreme Court decision in Shelley versus Kramer. The Supreme Court made at least two similar rulings that year, which struck down spatial restrictions based upon race. These decisions reinforced the moral authority of organizations like the League that were dealing with the unsustainable living conditions produced by these policies. The League reported for 1948 emphasized discrimination in both employer and housing and pointed out that housing discrimination problems had become so severe that it had temporarily added a housing secretary staff position. The Community Organization Department report continued to emphasize its block organization efforts and the Block Beautiful contest, but instead of reporting statistics, it now supplied only activities engaged in by the community, for example, the grass seeding activities along Calumet Avenue. The department proudly reported that it took teamwork, interest, and cooperation for neighbors in 52 city blocks to have loads of black dirt hauled into their areas, to plant grass seeds and flowers in spots long since void of any of these, and then to watch, nurture, and care for new grass and flowers from May to July. The department also reported that community participation in the Block Beautiful contest had almost tripled from the previous year, from 22 blocks participating in 1947 to 56 blocks participating in 1948. The pressing community issues for African Americans in 1948 were those related to the Chicago slum clearance program that was diminishing the already limited available stock of housing. For many, concern about the geographical and spatial marginalization of African Americans, the city's plan for relocating African Americans to other African American neighborhoods through the slum clearance efforts seem designed to achieve the same goals as restricted covenants. In a Chicago Tribune newspaper article entitled "Race and Relocation," Homer A. Jack, executive secretary of the Chicago Council Against Racial and Religious Discrimination, charged that many of the slum relocation sites selected for African Americans perpetuated residential segregation, and that the city administration is doing the site selection what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled private individuals could not do by restricted covenants. The league demanded that slum clearance relocation sites selected for displaced African American communities be located on vacant land, in new areas, on sizable tracts, and with a non-segregated pattern. Their demands were based on the reality that the African American communities they were serving and who were the primary targets of slum clearance were already being subjected to costly and unsustainable living conditions characterized by excessively high rents and dismissal kitchenettes, poor family health, and many other frightful situations. At a 1948 meeting with another civic-minded group, F.T. Lane would publicly advocate the execution of a slum prevention campaign that would curtail the land loss to a national slum clearance movement that had begun in 1937 under the leadership of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Lane pointed out that rehousing slum refugees is the bottleneck in slum redevelopment programs. There will be strenuous objections to Negroes moving to areas where there is vacant land, so slum dwellers can't leave the slums. Vacant land within the slums must be built up and made available at a price within reach of a people who need housing most. Of the seven objectives stated for the League's plan for 1949, at least three centered around community organization and improvement, to strengthen our community organization department so that it may do an improved job qualitatively and quantitatively. In direct contrast to and more cynical than the 1948 annual report, the 1949 report pictured a drawing of a fearful African-American male worker looking over his shoulder at an angry white male worker with a curled lip and wrinkled brow. This visual image resonated the 1949 theme, freedom from want, freedom from fear. As in 1948, the 1949 report describing activities for the League's Community Organization Department contained very little detailed statistical information about its activities. The report did, however, elucidate a consumer rights list that it had developed for and was communicating to African Americans in Chicago. The list included the rights: 1. To have free and equal access to and fully to participate in all community resources and facilities, especially public and private housing, public and private recreation, public and private health, and public and private welfare. 2. To develop a fuller sense of their responsibility for the maintenance, extension, and improvement of the total community resource and facilities. And 3. To overcome the special exploitation that they now endure as a result of illegal residential segregation and unmoral racial discrimination. The only factual information presented in the League's annual report about the department focused on its work with a property located at 215 to 219 East 31st Street. After interviewing 250 tenants, the Community Organization Department concluded that the structure was a public health threat to the occupants and that it should be demolished. According to the report, the property was in a similar condition to one at 56 and South Parkway, where 67 average-sized Americans lived in the basement next to the furnace, in the hallways, and in the partitioned rooms of what was some 40-odd year ago a six-family structure. It burnt. Seven lives were lost, including two children, who never had a chance. The Community Organization Department's acting director pointed out that with restricted covenants declared illegal, racial violence was still a real and critical tool in maintaining deadly and overcrowding living conditions for the vast majority of African Americans in Chicago. The fear among the community and especially returning veterans was of a Molotov cocktail being thrown through their windows, their children being burnt alive. These vets of World War II also feared the thought of a red brick crashing through their window. Unlike the 1948 annual report's plan for the following year, the 1949 annual report's plan did not list community organization work as a primary objective. This may have been tied to the fact that the Community Organization Department at the beginning of that year had no permanent director and had experienced reduced funding. Despite the brevity of the Community Organization Department's report in the League's 1949 annual report, internal documentation revealed that the department was engaged in a well-organized and thriving movement of conservation across the city. In its own internal annual report, the department described itself as the best grassroots organization within the city of Chicago and stated that its primary and fivefold emphasis in 1949, including the reactivation of block clubs and alleviating inhibitions of block club members. The internal report claimed the existence of 35 block clubs in the Parker Council and 15 organizational committees in the Snowdonville Community Council. Of the 8 outstanding activities identified for the year, 6 were environmental in scope and included securing and keeping better and brighter lighting, making street repairs on Princeton Street, buying and placing additional trash receptacles on the 700 block of 45th Street, and keeping vacant lots clean and planting flowers on 3900 Prairie Street. By the end of 1949, the Community Organization Department's acting director, Lillian Proctor, was submitting how-to organizational packets to other Urban League affiliates across the country. These packets provided information on how to launch a conservation movement in their respective cities. They contained, at a minimum, the Chicago Urban League's 5-year plan materials packet consisting of 5 brochures and a press release and 7 items in their Block Beautiful contest packet that included a judge's rating sheet, contest check sheet, kickoff letter, sponsor letter, and a Block Beautiful newsletter. Proctor also began to seek out well-developed constitutions from other league affiliates to distribute to Chicago neighborhood councils. All of the National League's community organization departments were working collaboratively during this time to create structured and well-organized sustainable communities in urban centers. Now well-established and 1 year away from the completion of the 5-year plan, but constrained by a reduced budget, the Community Organization Department decided at the end of 1949 that its emphasis for 1950 would be to respond to the block clubs on an as-need and as-requested basis and continued the League Beautiful program epitomized by the Block Beautiful contest that had begun in 1945. The department's goal to support its existing block organizations in 1950 was met with success. It almost doubled the number of active block units from 37 in May 1950 to 69 in December 1950. 24 of these new block clubs. Having active block units was critical to the conservation movement since most of them were engaged in improving their immediate neighborhoods. The year 1950 was also the 5th year of the League's Block Beautiful project and had the participation of 37 block clubs, 1 housing project, 2 neighborhood improvement associations, and 15 individuals. In early 1951, the department reported that its 3 major community projects for 1950, the Block Beautiful contest, the Better Homes and Yards contest, and the Christmas lighting contest, involved 1,700 people. The greatest participation was in the Block Beautiful contest. 75 city blocks and 500 people. The department continued to have internal problems through 1952 and reported that it had a complete turnover in its staff with the exception of the director, with all of the attendant problems of replacement and training new people. Despite personal problems, the organization was able to almost triple the number of active block clubs by December 1952, a total of 97. In addition to the Block Beautiful project, the block clubs were involved in multiple league-endorsed conservation efforts throughout the city, including the Board of Education's cleanup campaign and the Mayor's Cleaner Chicago Week. The block clubs were still focused on neighborhood improvement and conservation in 1952. Their activities ranged from working on children's play lots to hiring gardeners and street cleaners. The Chicago Urban League was proud of its environmental efforts. This was reflected in its 1952 The Next Step brochure, which asserted that it was the league which created the block or council type of community organization and the Block Beautiful scheme, the forerunner of modern community conservation and planning. In 1953, the community organization department's effort to recruit and maintain grassroots activism was successful, evidenced by the fact that by the end of the year, it was supervising a total of 141 block organizations. The momentum continued in 1953. The department reported that 163 blocks participated in the 1953 Block Beautiful project, including 5 public housing projects and 70 suburban blocks, an increase of 46 blocks from 1952. As in previous years, the blocks continued conservation efforts. In 1953, the block units participated in a street demonstration conducted by the league in cooperation with the Mayor's Committee on a Cleaner Chicago, the Police Department, and the Bureau of Streets and Sanitation. The block themselves sponsored bubble baths for streets, had seating parties, repaired streets, repaved sidewalks, secured better garbage collecting services, and succeeded in forcing peddlers into alleys. The Chicago Urban League considered its urban conservation movement as one of its greatest achievements. In 1954, they stated that they were the first to organize and to use block groups as a medium to prevent physical decay of neighborhoods. The environmental awareness and grassroots activism generated by the league was, in their eyes, manifested by the number of block clubs and the level of community participation in the annual Block Beautiful contest. By 1954, there are 162 active block units in the city of Chicago. Of these, 175 organized block units, active and non-active, participated in the annual Block Beautiful contest. The need for the league to claim this achievement was no doubt influenced by the recent and long overdue formal conservation efforts of the city of Chicago in 1953, which overshadowed the 40-year effort of the league. The year 1953 was a watershed time for urban conservation efforts by the city government. In April 1953, a Neighborhood Conservation Commission was created by the city ordinance and was made up of both public and elected officials. This commission was an advisory group established to help develop a program of public education and information on neighborhood conservation to stimulate local citizen action around 4 certified conservation areas that were slums. On September 9, 1953, amendments to the city ordinance that established the Neighborhood Redevelopment Commission were passed. These amendments gave authority to the commission to approve redevelopment plans that impacted no more than 2 city blocks or 160 acres and specifically address the issues of power of eminent domain for slum clearance and conservation. A city ordinance was then passed on September 23, 1953, that established a community conservation board authorized by the city's 1953 Urban Community Conservation Act. This 9-section act established and defined what was meant by the terms conservation area and conservation plan, and the legal actions needed to achieve conservation aims in Chicago. Like the decades-long assessments of the Chicago Urban League, Section 2 of the Act set forth the legislative finding and declarations, which declared that the already existing conservation areas were in danger of becoming slums and blighted, and that some of the factors contributing to the blight were lack of physical maintenance, overuse of housing and other facilities, and progressive and advanced deterioration of structures. Ironically, when a lengthy article outlining the legal and institutionally supported conservation efforts spearheaded by Mayor Kennelly and other politicians, including former Governor Green, appeared in a 1953 issue of Commerce Magazine, there was no mention of the decades-long conservation efforts of the interracial Chicago Urban League. Instead, the article, Chicago Fights Slums Before They Develop, focused on the two-year community effort of the Southeast Chicago Commission, headed by the University of Chicago Chancellor's Lawrence A. Kempton, and the recent block movement by the racially controversial Hyde Park, Kenwood, and Oaklawn Neighborhood Associations.
I say, racially controversial? Come on now, Dr. Hood. Racial terrorist enclaves. You mean racially controversial? Come on. Come on. Come on. Come on. You got to... Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Racially controversial? Racially controversial? Is Dylann Roof racially controversial? So we got the epilogue. It is 20 minutes. I don't know. We'll have to chat for a minute and see. We'll see how much, after folks share their thoughts, we'll see where we're at time-wise and go from there. What a pickle. So the number is 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The epilogue is important for many reasons. One, I say when you read these books, you got to read the footnotes. So the first footnote for the epilogue reads, I already mentioned Lorraine Hansberry, cowbell. Keep that in mind, cowbell, as I read the footnote, cowbell. Lorraine Hansberry took her title, Raisin in the Sun, from the famous poet Langston Hughes' poem, A Dream Deferred, because she felt that it embodied the plight of Chicago's African-American community. Lorraine was the daughter of the successful real estate man, Carl Hansberry, who owned and managed kitchenette properties in Chicago. Carl rose to even greater prominence with a legal case involving a restrictive covenant covering his personal residence in 1940, Hansberry v. Lee. This case was critical to the NAACP's eventual 1948 Supreme Court victory in overturning restrictive covenants in Shelley v. Kramer. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of Hansberry in 1940 by striking down the validity of the restrictive covenant that was supposedly in force in the Washington Park neighborhood where he had moved in 1938. Lorraine, a small child at the time, she's about the same age as Dr. Welsing. Lorraine Hansberry, she's born just a few years after Dr. Welsing. Lorraine, a small child at the time, would be victimized by violent attacks on her home by angry whites who objected to the family's presence. Again, this is not depicted in Raisin in the Sun. There are racists in Raisin in the Sun, but they are very nice, very timid, very polite, mild-mannered. They do not throw bricks. They knock politely on the door and ask kindly if the African Americans would not relocate to the white area. They do not say, niggers, we do not want your kind around here, coon. They don't say that. They just say, please, kindly, we'll pay you twice what the residence is worth if you will consider not moving. Again, Raisin in the Sun, the vain villain, I was going to say the plot, but kind of the villain is kind of the black male. Sidney Poitier's character, Walter Lee Jones. Him, like I said, he takes all the money from his dead father and invested in a liquor store that's stolen by another no-count black male, and they're left with nothing as they try to move out to the racist neighborhoods. But that is, maybe we have to Raisin in the Sun. Maybe that's for another day on the book club, but I'm sure a lot of folks have read that. A lot of people have to read that in school and all the rest. Anywho, all the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Thomas in New York, retired firefighter, our narrator Henry in Chicago. If you did not get to share already, you should go ahead and get a hand up now. Please don't wait till the last minute. Have to see if we have time to get the episode. Folks, we've missed Tucker. Proceed.
Hey, Gus, I think that in that, I might have read the book in school, I don't remember, but didn't the son give the money to another black male to go gamble, and he was supposed to go and double the money or something, and he didn't come back, but that could have just been the movie version of the whole thing, Raisin in the Sun. Why is the solutions to the problems created by white people. Always, we need to do some training, or we need to clean up, or we need to change our image. It's never them. You know, that was the solution in Baltimore with the lead that they caused, that they were supposed to cover and didn't, and it affected people, and it seems to be the same thing. In Chicago, the problem is overcrowding. However, you know, somehow they convinced the black people that the problem is the neighborhood aesthetics. And, you know, let's ignore the actual problem. And let's focus on making it look nice. Let's focus on the perception it gives when other people bypass here, you know, when white people bypass. You don't want to be riding past a tacky-looking area, you know, and the emphasis on that is just, and like you said, Dr. Wells and Wood always say, she sounded like she was probably in a block club, you know, where, you know, clean that neighborhood up, and, you know, I'll drop something, pick it up, you know, and that was what they were trained to do, black people, you know, and of course, keeping your area clean is, you know, great. However, I'm quite sure that the problems aside that in the area were way more important, you know, but that's what, even the Christmas tree lighting contest, I was waiting for the Christmas tree lighting contest. They used to have one of those where I grew up, you know, the Block Association on that at the Claremont Avenue in Jersey City, and these 10 houses would go out. I mean, now, also, the mindset of the whole thing, clean up this neighborhood, it automatically instilled in the black people who live there, because a lot of these are homeowners, and that you're not going to get anything better than this. You know, like, don't aspire to get out of here, this overcrowded black area, you know, or just this overcrowded area. You know, just try to fix up what you have, you know. And I'm sure it left a lot of people stagnated as well, you know, instead of aspiring to get out of that area where it's overcrowded and disease and things of that nature, which later become crime infested, you know, they stayed and just fixed up what they had, you know, as opposed to saving and probably moving, not to a white area, but just to a less crowded area, if you catch what I'm saying.
Indeed. I think it's difficult because, so if it's 1940, 1950, and it's, okay, we're in the South Side, we're in the black slum, the ghetto, so they say, and housing is terrible and everything. So if you don't want to move here, the better housing is where the white people live, but you don't want to move with the racists, so where would you go? You don't have all of the infrastructure, like to say, well, I'm going to go stay someplace where it's not a whole lot of people. Well, at that time, that would mean probably someplace that doesn't have a road or probably toilets or running water even. That would probably mean that they don't have infrastructure built up. You're probably going to someplace that's an unincorporated because they don't have suburbs and all that stuff is not built up at if you're going someplace where the white people aren't. So are you going out in the country or, you know, it would be. And how far is this going to be from your job? Do you have a car to commute? Like, white people have lots of ways to make it challenging for housing for black people. But Dr. Well, absolutely, it sounds like she would have been in a block association Christmas decoration contest. Not like I said, no problem with cleaning. Hey, let's all get an A in broom. Right on. Let's do a little. I said I'm going to clean up when we go off. A plus, no problem there. It just sounds like this would have been a direct influence on what we heard so frequently. Like, wow, I would have been tickled to ask her about that. Like, did you participate in any, does any of this sound familiar to the Chicago? Like, man, just to see what she would have said. Let's see. Other folks who are with us, hand up, especially if we haven't heard you so far. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter? Yes, sir.
Yes. From a historical standpoint, she probably did participate in such programs as a child. Hold on. Have to turn off an alarm that went off. Yes, she probably did participate in such programs at that time, because I can actually recall as a child where such programs in the area that was included on your program years ago by Mr. Dunn was doing some of the same things during that time. By me listening to the readings, what I get out of them is is from the standpoint of the racists have limited purposes for non-white black people. And basically it's their strategy to contain us, not to allow, especially during that time, not to allow any black people to filter into areas where white people stay at. So you had within these areas, as everybody is stating, and also the book was stating, overcrowded areas. You had the preacher, the teacher, the lawyer, the doctor, all of those people stayed in the same general area. But one of the biggest issues that probably was a means to keep the area impoverished, is not the right word, in a terrible condition, is the lack of services. Is to really curtail the lack of services that comes back, that's opposed to support in a quote unquote community, a living area. If it's apartment-like complexes, maintenance people are not going to be that good in areas where black people reside at. Still today, I would say, and it's on purpose from that standpoint. One thing that I did not hear through the entire book that I thought probably would be interesting on how the writer would compare on how it factors into things is something that was called the GI Bill. And the reason why I mention that is because it was supposedly designed for veterans, and veterans make up a lot of males during that time, especially, and black males included. But there was a, of course, you know, with the GI Bill and what it benefits from, black males were going to get the least of it, for sure, as far as going to be able to go to college or also a down payment on a mortgage, that sort of thing. And it would have been interesting on how the writer would have been able to factor that particular thing into what she was talking about in this particular portion of the book, I was thinking. And those are some of my thoughts on it all together. But I'll have a few more as the conversation goes on. Thank you.
Much obliged. Retired firefighter Dr. Marvin Dunn. I think you mentioned him. He's been a guest on the program, I think, three times
right
now. Three times. Cal Bell. Mm. Wowee. Important. Wowee. Mm. Anywho, much obliged, retired firefighter. Purposeful, very purposeful, the way white people engage in activities with us. Other folks who have a hand up, comments they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago. Yes, sir.
All right. This one caught my eye. It said nine major riots between 1945 and 1953. Now, I know a lot of emphasis has always been put on the Chicago riots of 1919, but nine major riots between 1945 and 1953 and 217 attacks in between those years. I thought that was very, very interesting. On page 148, A.L. Foster's quote, where part of it says, denied the right and privilege of American citizenship. This is why I feel that being American is being white, because the white people are the only ones who benefit from American citizenship. I don't believe black people are American citizens, so, you know, that's just me. But A.L. Foster kind of, you know, echoes my sentiments of, you know, black people so-called being American citizens. Oh, my God, the one on page 179 of the Chicago Urban League report of 1948, and how they used Larry Doby, who was a former Cleveland Indians baseball player. He was actually the first American League black baseball player. Jackie Robinson was in the National League, and Doby was the first American League baseball player. And Steve Gromick, I was trying to look for it, because the way Dr. Hood described it was just, like, hilarious, because it was, like, long, toothy smiles on their face, epitomizing mutual acceptance. I mean, when he said long, toothy smiles, I thought about the Cleveland Indians logo with that, you know, with that grinning, you know, so-called Indian caricature on there. And it was just like, oh, my God. And then the baseball metaphors was just, you know, it was just funny. I was just thinking about, like, wow, what confusion in this pamphlet. I just did not understand how people, like, accepted that particular pamphlet. But I thought it was just, you know, wow. I think you said it, Gus, confusion is lethal. And that would have been very confusing. And in regards to the, you know, block clubs and Dr. Welsing and cleaning up your neighborhoods, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, it might not have been on your show, but I remember Dr. Welsing was saying about some sort of mental aspect of, you know, living in a clean environment, you know, because, you know, you basically gain much more self-respect, you know, living in a
clean environment, black self-respect, I guess. But at the same time, and I understand what Thomas in New York and others were saying about, you know, there are other problems, because I'm pretty sure towns like Tulsa, Oklahoma, Rosewood, Florida, Wilmington, North Carolina, were also clean neighborhoods, but they were also, you know, neighborhoods where the black economy was, you know, thriving, and white people bombed and burned those communities. So that's all I have in my line.
Much obliged. Excuse me. Much obliged, Henry, in Chicago. Were there other folks who had commentary? Great observations about the so-called riots, because you don't hear about it. Like I said, I don't think people would say, like, yeah, Chicago, white people were just bombing and attacking and killing white people. I'm killing black people left and right. Like, they almost killed Lorraine Hansen. Like, I just don't. I would have loved to ask Dr. Welsing about that. Like, all these bombings, did you remember all that? Did you live through some of the, like, yeah, like, what, man. Missed opportunities. Reading is more important than watching television. I would have asked her about this and The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. I didn't find that out until we interviewed Sabrina Johnson, that was like pet project. That was something she was really interested in. Like, oh, wow, that would have. Oh, well. Other folks that we missed totally, comments to share? Assume we got everybody for the time being. Photograph has been located. Mr. Gromek and Larry Doby. I'll post it on my Facebook page if folks want to check it out. She did a pretty accurate job describing it. And white people apparently have got a lot of mileage behind this photograph. Like, it's infamous, and every time pretty much it looks like it's mentioned. Like, oh, yeah, the triangle. In fact, the very Cleveland Indians logo that he mentioned is in the photograph. It's on Mr. Doby's sleeve. It's on his left shoulder sleeve as he's embracing this white man, Mr. Gromek, I guess that's how you say his name. But yeah, it's so it's got three smiles, the black male, the white man, and the Indians mascot, all gleaming, pearly whites in the photograph. Let's see. I'll get my notes from this portion of the reading. Let's see. It said restrictive covenants were in effect and were being legally and violently violently enforced. Chicago Mayor Dwight H. Green had appointed Judge Leonard C. Reed, who openly supported and had signed restrictive covenants, to the circuit court. The front headlines for the Chicago Defender on March 10, 1945 were "Hoodlums Attack Two Homes" and "Governor Green Slaps Negroes." That was what caused me confusion. It's a whole lot there in terms of the violence and violence, bombings, all of that. But they said Governor Green slaps Negroes, and I took it literally, like, oh, wow, the governor came out and slapped two black people? And then I kept reading and said, oh, names race-hating. Oh, I was like, oh, okay, metaphors. Compensatory calling, that's a Saturday thing. But I was confused for about 30 seconds. I thought he literally came out and slapped some people. They had more of the interracial groups. They came down at the bottom. And they said they had a 17-member interracial citizens committee, and they listed all the people that are on this group, and they said their objectives were twofold. First, to educate the Negroes to their own rights as citizens, and second, to help them make a better adjustment to city living. And I just thought the paternalism, as well as what our narrator just shared in terms of who qualifies to be a citizen. Sometimes it seems like you got to be white, or that white and citizen are synonymous anywhere in the world. Let's see. 176. Oh, and they mentioned the attacks. They said on that same page just above, they said it was 217 reported attacks against a property alone. I mean, talking about those numbers that narrator just cited, Henry in Chicago, like, violence. The system of white supremacy, Mr. Fuller said, it's deception, direct violence. Lots and lots of direct violence. In fact, that's what I feel like it's most of this book has been about. Like, not even the title, Packing Them In, is like a violent act. Like, you got a cattle prod or something. Yeah, get in there, stuff, you know, 20 of them in there. And then you got fires and all the rest of it. I mean, it's just violence. But I feel like I've heard much more of that than so-called agency. I think that's what I said it for. So they'll try and, you know, really force that. Like, Negroes have lots of agency. You know, they got in and do this, and white people don't just beat them down. They're not just victims and all the rest of it. In this book, I mean, yeah, you know, Du Bois did this, and Blockus, yeah, it just seems like a lot of victimization. White people being very terroristic, on top of the chemical and biological warfare, but just naked violence. Let's see. Editorials by readers of The Defender included cleanliness, key to better housing, and urges Negroes to help themselves, that respectability, long running, and spoke to the need for African Americans to optimize their living spaces since they had little chance of escaping into better and cleaner spaces. Now, the last part of it, now why is that? Why is it that if we clean up and we do all this mopping and cleaning and no trash, that we can't escape? Even that word, escape, like we're fugitives or convicts or something. Like, why is that, that we're stuck here even then? It continues. In the spring of 1945, one Defender reader asked in an editorial, don't you think we could get or rent flats or homes in better neighborhoods if we were cleaner and more progressive in the homes we now live in? This is a question. Absolutely not. And Mr. Fuller, and I know a lot of other black people, said that this is the way that they thought. Around this time period, in fact. They said it took a while before they kind of came to the conclusion, like, no, we could be super clean. James Baldwin, he has a line in Evidence of Things Not Seen, which is about the so-called Atlanta child murders. And he says that his generation of black people, they were like the most well-scrubbed, clean, because they didn't want to have any accusations that they were lazy or unkempt or didn't, you know, clean up, weren't deodorized, all of that. And he said it took a while to grasp, like, oh, that's not it at all. Like, we could be the cleanest, most well-schooled, well-oiled little black boys and girls ever, and we're still just, Nick, what I said in the first one, niggers is niggers. We got rebellious niggers, we got clean niggers, southern niggers, singing niggers is niggers. It took a while to kind of grasp, like, man, this is not, what is happening here? Like, I thought this was, you know, on us, like we were doing something to deserve this or something, and that's not the case at all. Let's see. The Urban League. Oh yeah, the baseball photo, we got that. Great use of descriptors. All of this, I'd be remiss with World War II. Like, they do a lot of that. We all got to come together, and we all came together. That's a total lie. We discussed the book. I have to go back to get the title about how white women in the North in, like, Michigan rioted because they hired a few black females to come work as, like, custodial workers in an auto plant to help with the war effort. And it was not, oh, yeah, we're all in this together, and let's be paid. It was, what? What are these niggers doing here? And they're going to eat with us? Oh, my God. And they wouldn't even let them come eat in the cafeteria. They made them go eat their lunch in the bathroom stall. I mean, just disgraceful conduct. So that should not be minimized at all. World War II, we did not all come together. We practiced racism and, you know, just reorganize how the planet works under that system of racism. Let's see. Privileges of American Citizenship, A.L. Foster. Privileges of Whiteness, Power of Whiteness. Let's see. Anything else? Homemakers. A lot of this just seems a lot like respectability politics. So by the end of 1947, the department reported that it had three active neighborhood councils who were holding annual banquets. Those banquets and with total attendance of 300 people. It also conducted a homemakers workshop aimed at improving housekeeping practices, as well as a co-op food buying demonstration to protest high prices. The community organization department made it clear that block units on the city's south side were identified as such only after areas were divided into natural sections and then into blocks. We'll stop there. Just all of this is grand and encouraging some sort of, you know, cleaning or tips on cleaning. Great, wonderful. White people do that too. And I think there's also with this like an implication that white people are super clean and all of that. And aren't they the ones who have housekeepers? And I have seen a number of hoarders. There's a lot of white people on there who are not clean and tidy at all. That's the type of thing that it suggests, that if you're white, you automatically are tidy and clean and have a well-kept house, which is frequently not the case. Last one I'll get in. Or the vibe. Maybe I'll get in three. So they said the poor racial attitudes of badly coached white. Oh, they were talking about baseball. So this is after the photo. So the poor racial attitudes of badly coached white rookies, according to the league, had been absorbed by altogether too many first-generation white citizen players, which seems to cause them to believe that the acquisition of a strong anti-Negro bias is the first base they must reach to qualify to become good, respectable Americans. Whites. What a metaphor. Get in the first place, mistreating the Negro. Foundation in Whiteness, America. The report gave a listing of negative racial attitudes that the league felt were contributing to the city's and the country's forfeiture of democracy. Among these were included the frequently opined, "Let's run or burn them out, else our property will lose its value," from a white neighborhood protective association. They got organizations too. Run or burn them out. Bombing. That's why I said that's my takeaway, is violence. It's not, you know, wow, black people were really successful in Chicago and getting that pollution and chemicals out. It was, nope, they were bombed and beaten and victims of violence from 1865 to 1954 in Chicago. And pollution. Let's see. The next one. Says in 1948, the 1949 report describing, as in 1948, the 1949 report describing activities for the league's community organization department contained very little detailed statistical information about its activities. The report did, however, elucidate a consumer rights list that had developed for and was communicating to African Americans in Chicago. The list included the rights to have free, equal access to fully participate in all community resources. And it developed a fuller sense of their responsibility for maintenance, extension, and improvement of the total community resources and facilities, but they don't have power over any of these things. That was kind of kept coming back to me. You're not in control of any of these things. Coming down a little bit, it says the community organization department's acting director pointed out that with restrictive covenants declared illegal, racial violence was still a real and critical tool in maintaining deadly and overcrowded living conditions for the vast majority of African Americans in Chicago. That is still the case today. The fear among the community, and especially returning veterans, was of a Molotov cocktail being thrown through their windows, their children being burned alive. That will be my takeaway from packing them in, among many, but I mean that right there. Returning veterans, like Jackie Robinson, World War II veteran. Returning veterans, coming back fighting Hitler. We wanted to beat the Nazis, and we come back to the Windy City, Chicago, Illinois, and I'm afraid that my house will be bombed and my children burned alive. Not in Alabama, not in Florida, not in Mississippi, in Chicago. Packing them in. System of white supremacy. Direct, naked violence. And plenty of it. And I was going to say in this chapter, but it was kind of from beginning to end. Violence and violence and violence. Plenty of it. And lots of footnotes in this one. Let's see. I was just seeing a footnote, making sure we didn't miss any important footnotes. We had all this violence and such. She did have a few extra details, but they weren't about the bombings per se in the footnotes. If you get the book, read the footnotes. With that, any other comments folks wanted to share? I think we'll have to do the epilogue like as an addendum. We'll move on to a new book for next Thursday, but before next Thursday, we'll do an addendum and get the epilogue in so that we will have the entirety of the text and any final thoughts. Did any folks have any additional comments they wanted to share today?
Oh my God, I saw the picture. This picture is hilarious. the Larry Doby and Steve Gromick picture. Oh my God, I'm just shaking my head.
All three, mascot included, like system of whites, and they got years of, like, they talked about it for years and years, and like, what a moment. Oh, it's just incredible. Teammates, cheek to cheek. He's actually touching the Negro. Can you see? Face to face. Oh, incredible. Yeah. And they won the way. This is from the World Series, too, so they got, you know, a lot of mileage from this.
I would say that being that Larry Doby was the second black person in the modern day era of the major leagues, and at that time it was the baseball, I think, was still at the top as far as professional sports in this part of the world, and him being a black person certainly would have probably drawn a lot of black people's attention at the time. So, you know, white people know what they know how to advertise. I put it that way. They definitely know how to advertise.
Absolutely. Thomas in New York.
Yeah, I think this book did a great job of taking white ignorance and privilege out of the conversation. She did a great job pointing out in detail that whites were in these conditions and had the same diseases and filth prior to the blacks moving there. Not just the most powerful whites, but even the ethnic whites had a stern understanding of exactly what was going to be the result of living in those conditions that they put the blacks in when they first went to Chicago. And as you said, whites, number one people on hoarders. Every episode I see almost a white person disgusting. And they usually have a non-white person who they consider as dirty, cleaning and cooking for them. And the book made mention very, you know, good that they do the same thing to Asians, stereotype of carrying diseases. But in uniform, they're all of a sudden cooks and dry cleaners, just perfect. And the last thing, the Southern blacks moving north, I could see how the cleanliness, the brainwashing of the cleanliness being the cause of your problems and also the way out of your problems led to a lot of anti-blackness, especially people coming from the South who didn't have as much money. Weren't from the city, didn't understand some things, and were probably not as tip-top dressed, and putting on, presenting the image of this cleanliness that we still do today. You know, we're going to put on some expensive clothes and real expensive cologne, but, you know, we live in the projects or something, you know. But here come these people who aren't presenting that image at first because they haven't been indoctrinated into that mindset and how they would be looked down on by the other blacks. So I could see that the anti-blackness just permeating at this time in Chicago, probably causing a lot of black-on-black violence as well. And I'll meet my line. Thank you, Justin.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Racists are phenomenal at fomenting that anti-blackness in a lot of different ways, just getting black people, non-white people in general, to argue and squabble with each other over nothing. when the problem remains the system of white supremacy. But yeah, lots of effective strategies at producing that conflict between victims. Other folks, any other comments they wanted to share?
Could I add something?
Caller in Canada, yes, sir.
On last week's read from the text, there's a part in here that says the prevailing thought of African Americans as diseased bodies contributed to the planning policies that restrict the geological space. I think that line sums up what packing in the author's intent for really what the whole book is. Because like even when Trump is calling it the coronavirus, he's implying that non-white people are diseased bodies, right? So, and it doesn't matter how clean we are, the fact that we are seen as diseased bodies because we're not white, that is just a prevailing thought. Even from a hundred of years ago up until present day. And that's it. I'll mute my line.
To use the term quarantine in the book, got to quarantine the Negroes, which is kind of what they're talking about right now in New York City. They were talking about quarantining the state. Then Chicago becoming a so-called hot spot. In fact, I think that I saw an article today and it said Wisconsin and Michigan tell Chicagoans stay away. Like, we don't want you all hanging out here. You got all that, you know, the Chinese virus. Like, you know, stay out there until you get things resolved. Like, wow. And then you heard that all compounded system of racism, white supremacy, for all the reasons that she laid out in this book, Packing Them In, Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington. So the epilogue, we will nab sometime between now and next Thursday. By the time we get to next Thursday, we'll be on to a new book, and that new book could very well be The American Problem, the Negro, mentioned in this book. That's where I first heard of it. Thomas in New York mailed it to me. I think that's what we should read, unless like it's really dry and not entertaining. Did anybody actually, Thomas in New York mailed it to me. I haven't had a chance to check it out. Has anybody actually flipped through it to think, yeah, we should read this? Or it's kind of dry, you know, it's not really worth hanging out to actually read. But I think that's, how could it not be? Did anybody get a chance to check it out?
The brief reading that I did on it, it sounded a lot like the Rising Tide of Reefs type of verbiage, kind of pushing that Darwinian mindset. And I usually, you know, when I want to check a book out, I turn to page 33. I don't know why, but that number keeps popping up for me. So when I read page 33, 34, like to 38, just to get a touch of it, and they were pushing a lot of the that white science of these Negroes are not human, and this is why they should be treated this way. So that's what I got from
Gus.
Yes, sir.
I was just wondering, did you receive the text that I sent to you? Because you mentioned about the importance of still talking about racism, white supremacy in this global context of this Canora virus, and I sent you something that kind of like confirms on what we are doing. Did you receive it?
Absolutely, much obliged, sir.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. I got it off of a radio program.
I have been seeing more reports of that nature. Like I got the one that you sent me earlier in the week. You know, saying, "Yep, this is correct to be talking about this, even under the global pandemic, to be talking about racism, because that's still the problem." And He sent that report that was saying that they were starting to talk about how racism was impacting the treatment and who was being impacted, and that I've seen more and more reports saying the same thing, that black people aren't getting tested to see if they have it and if they should be quarantined, and that if a black person calls in with symptoms, they're less likely to be treated and getting the same type of attention as a white person who, you know, reports that they have symptoms and goes to see a healthcare official. So, yeah, there's, again, the plague in the known universe, individuals classified as white, racist man, racist woman, racist child. That is the plague in the known universe. Other folks, anything else folks need to share before we call it a broadcast? We'll get the epilogue in the next 5 days or so, and then we'll make a decision. Is it the American problem, the Negro, or we'll be picking a different book? But we'll make that decision and let folks know so we can prep for a new book next Thursday. Epilogue will be done sometime before next Thursday. Anything else?
I guess my, you know, the book, this book was very informative, you know, living in Chicago, growing up here in Chicago as well. There were still some things in the book that, you know, I didn't know about. So that's where, that was what was impressive about it, you know, because, you know, you think you know about an area that, that you lived in and grew up in, and you really don't know much. So, I thought this book was very informative in regards to, you know, the racial environmental aspect, of not just, the, you know, the segregated areas, but the environment, and not just like air quality, but, you know, other factors within Chicago, and why Chicago is what it is now. So, you know, you hear about it, you know, just like with the bombings, you know, it's like, it's almost like a whisper amongst the old people. You know, they know about it, but they don't talk much about it. So that's all I had on my mind.
Context of white supremacy. Yeah, was, Thomas in New York, go ahead.
That was kind of left out of the reading, what he just said. But this was Chicago at the turn of the century, the Industrial Revolution. The skies would have looked a lot like China did 10 years ago, all pitch black, all the factories, all of the ships coming in with their steam plumes. I mean, there wasn't the environmental protection agencies and things like that yet. So this would have been even contributed to the environmental conditions they lived in. Back to the coronavirus, just can't emphasize enough how this has shifted from being something that only affects Chinese people to us, it doesn't affect black people, to now only being having a huge outbreak, you know, new cases in black parts. And I'm looking for the black belt of the United States, the South, to be next. Alabama, you know, Mississippi, those places where they could easily corner that off. And even in the city where black people live, we live segregated. So it's easy, very easy to corner us off, those filthy people, and keep us in a, you know, in a state of quarantine in our own area. And I'm with myself. Thank you, guys.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Anything else? I'm sure we'll have lots more time to discuss the Chinese disease. Any other comments folks have?
Gus, I'll send you one of the articles that I was talking about earlier about the 1918 Spanish flu and its effects in Chicago.
More white people being impacted. So-called segregation might have been quarantine, kept in to preserve black people and keeping them safe, ironically. But thank you kindly. Have to check that out, see if they have, ponder on that and think why that was. Especially because, you know, white people were not stopping going to the Vice District to go do some sexual sewering while all that was happening. That will wrap for today. We will get the epilogue in. Talking about Lorraine Hansberry, cowbell. We'll get the epilogue in, and then shuffle off to a new book. I was even thinking maybe we should read something, I don't know, health related, since we're doing in the middle of this fight. It would have been great. We could have read Medical Apartheid now, but already got that. Or Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, already knocked that off. Been cool to read something health related, but have to think about it. Yeah, have to think about it. The American problem. The Negro has my attention, but we'll see. Anyway, tomorrow we will be here neutralizing workplace racism. Looking forward to that, seeing again how everything has impacted folks' workplace code. Compensatory call-in is on Saturday. Wednesday. Next Wednesday, Dr. Ruby Lathan will be here discussing, you know, how you can use this time to brush up on your cooking skills, use this time to eat better so that you're not in the diabetic and obese category. That is more likely to be fatal if you get any of the complications with all of this. That's what the governor of Louisiana reported this week. But Dr. Lathan, she'll be with us next Wednesday. You'll have to check the schedule, see if we have other programs. And we'll have the epilogue somewhere in there as well. So lots of broadcasts to help us get through the isolation, shelter in place as we try to get through it all. If you have questions, comments, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged for everyone's participation. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Keep our brain computer functioning at the highest capacity. We got lots of problems to solve. We will need high powered thinking. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. There are race soldiers aplenty, especially now. We shouldn't be driving too many places, but man, oh man, the few times that you are out and about, sober, buckled, and you are strategic about where you're going, you are alert. This is not a time that you want to be reckless moving about in space. I know here in Seattle, they said they had a major article. They said thousands of phone calls, white people snitching on folks for violating the stay-at-home order and calling enforcement officials and starting online forums. This is not an environment where you want to be, you know, kind of careless when you leave your residence. To that end, if you're driving, you want to be buckled, sober, and not on a cell phone. Because you might be stopped, you might have to present paperwork that you're an essential worker or anything to verify what you're doing, where you're going, who you are, that you don't have anything. It's a lot of things you want to be attentive to right now. Let's make sure we're not on the phone. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
no
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.